makes a move of which we don't approve. Who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines. We'll send them all we've got. John Wayne and Randolph Scott. Remember those exciting fighting scenes. To the shores of Tripoli, but not to Mississippi. What do? We send the Marines. For might makes right. Until they've seen the light, they've got to be protected. All their rights respected. Till somebody we like can be elected. Members of the Corps all hate the thought of war. They'd rather kill them off by peaceful means. Stop calling it aggression. Ooh, we hate that expression. We only want the world to know that we support the status quo. They love us everywhere we go. So when in doubt, send the Marines.
Listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Women who were dismissed from employment in the 1950s and early 60s for being married or pregnant may be one step closer to receiving long-denied pensions. On Tuesday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a group of women who say that Minnesota Power in Duluth discriminated against them by placing penalties on their pensions based on outdated gender rules. In the 50s and 60s, Minnesota Power had a policy that women employed with them who became married or pregnant were to be laid off. Many of the women were able to get their jobs back in the late 70s or early 80s, but when they retired, the company refused to count their first years of employment toward their pension. The ruling allows the women to proceed with their lawsuit. If the suit is won, it could set a precedent for millions of other women who faced similar discrimination decades ago and are now reaching retirement age.
Delta Airlines announced a major restructuring plan yesterday in an effort it says will allow the company to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline is closing its Dallas-Fort Worth hub, eliminating 7,000 jobs and 10% of its workforce. Also in the mix is an across-the-board wage cut for all employees, which Delta says is necessary due to increased competition and fuel prices. Older members of the pilots' union are threatening to retire early if Delta doesn't promise to protect their accrued benefits. Rick Aronson is a Boeing 757 pilot.
We're tired of jobs going overseas, and in the airline industry, we're afraid our pensions are going to be lost, and we're afraid that President Bush is going to allow foreign carriers to take our American airline jobs.
The airline industry overall is in crisis, with United Airlines having already filed for bankruptcy, and American and ATA have threatened bankruptcy.
When employees walked out of a Nestle USA plant in Freehold, New Jersey last month, attempting to get the company to sit down at the bargaining table, they were offered a Hobson's choice. Accept the new company-wide health care program or stay out on strike and lose their paychecks and benefits altogether. The workers said that it was the first time in that factory's history that the company has not allowed workers to negotiate where the cost of their benefits will go. In order to protect their jobs, the workers relented and returned to work. The strike was not necessarily about rising health care costs as much as it was about workers losing their voices in the company.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Cash-strapped parents are feeling the pinch as schools across the country increase the price of lunch due to rising costs. The average high school lunch costs about $1.66 and $1.43 for elementary school lunches. According to a recent survey by Education Week, price increases ranged anywhere from 30 cents in Atlanta to $1 in California. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
After 9/11, there was a headline on a French paper, "Today We Are All Americans." We had the world on our side in a way that hasn't been seen since post-World War II. Within, you know, a few months after that, with the obsession with Iraq, it was washed away. I was a registered Republican, now I'm a Democrat, and I'm voting for John Kerry in November.
MoveOnPAC is responsible for the content of this advertisement. Isn't it good to know that the humongous Department of Homeland Security is so wisely spending our tax dollars to defend us from terrorists? Take, for example, the slick mass mailings recently put out by DHS urging America's homeowners to buy flood insurance. Yes, flood insurance. In the midst of various color-coded warnings about imminent terrorist attacks on America, our Homeland Security authorities are spending their time and our money to hawk flood policies on behalf of giant insurance corporations. In a breathless and alarmist letter mailed to thousands of people, including my friend Susan, Mr. Michael Brown, purporting to be the Undersecretary for Emergency Preparedness and Response, warns in bold type that floods can happen anywhere. In a scary red tag warning on the envelope, Undersecretary Brown direly informs us that homeowners insurance doesn't cover you for America's number one natural disaster. So, in his letter, this homeland czar shrieks in blood-red type, "Don't delay! Get flood insurance today!" Ever so helpfully, he even provides the name and number of selected agents in your area who sell these insurance policies, urging you to call your agent. Of course, the vast majority of homeowners don't live in a floodplain and have no need whatsoever to waste their hard-earned money on such insurance. Indeed, my friend Susan lives on an upslope that has never, ever come close to being flooded. Also, Susan is not even a homeowner. Yet in the enclosed brochure, the Homeland authorities declare that flood insurance is for everyone. This is Jim Hightower saying, why is our government shilling for insurance giants, fraudulently peddling policies to people who don't need them and will never collect on them? If the Homeland Security Department doesn't have anything better to do than run insurance scams, Congress should yank its $40 billion a year budget.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too. But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. As the United States goes so often, so goes the world, at least over the last 150 years, more or less. Hopefully into the future, if we can get this great nation back on course. Boy, a lot to talk about it today. We have a couple of interesting guests on here as well. Hurricane Ivan. Just talking with Detective Brutka in our chat room here. He's down in Florida, and Hurricane Ivan starting to make the folks in Florida a little twitchy, and with some justification, 160-mile-an-hour winds just took out Grenada. I remember last time Louise and I were down there. It's been, 10, 12 years, something like that. What a beautiful place. But apparently 90% of the buildings there are severely damaged. I mean, just this is a serious storm. Brought to you, and see, now this is the part of the story, the rest of the story, that you're not hearing on the evening news, that they routinely report on the evening news in other countries. Brought to you courtesy of the fossil fuel industry. I was in Australia a year before last. They were having those giant fires that were moving up on Sydney. We were in Sydney. The news, I
just, you know, staying with a friend, turned on the TV, watched the evening news, and they come on and they talk about, you know, where the fires are and how they're going. And the guy, and then the guy shows a map of Australia, and he says, you know, predictions based on, you know, what they, in fact, they prefaced the thing by saying the fires, you know, the dry land, the dry weather that is producing these fires is the predictable consequence of global warming, which has been going on, you know, picking up pace over the last 20 years, showing up here in Australia. And then after he does the local story, more or less, about, you know, what parts of Sydney might have to be concerned, or the region around it, there in New South Wales, he goes to a map of the whole country and says, and these are the regions over the next 10, 15 years as global warming continues, as these trends continue, where we can expect to see more droughts, and here are the regions where we can expect to see flooding, and here's, and he just lays it out very matter-of-factly. I was in the UK about 4 or 5 years ago. I was teaching a workshop there with McKenna Breen, the folks who put on Richard Bandler's NLP seminars. It was an NLP weekend workshop, in fact, that I was teaching with Michael Breen in London. And it just happened to be, it was in the fall. It must have been October, November, something like that. And it just happened to be the week that England got hit with these 60-mile-an-hour winds. I mean, it was just in gale-force winds. Flying into that thing reminded me of the only other time I've actually landed in that kind of weather was, I don't know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Flew into hurricane or tropical storm, as I recall, it was Stephen, in the Philippines. And we landed, it was a typhoon, and we landed in Manila in a typhoon, and the plane was creaking. You could hear bolts popping, it being pitched around, luggage falling out of the overhead compartment. This was a 747, and you could hear the thing creaking and cracking, the wings bending. I mean, it was wild. And so anyhow, in London, teaching this workshop, and, you know, in the evening in the hotel room, turn on the TV, what's the news? And they're talking about how the wild weather that they're having in the U.K., was the clear and predictable result. This is what the global climate scientists have been predicting, and this, you know, we can expect to see more of this around this time of year. All very matter of fact. These words aren't even uttered here. And yet we've known for two decades. Known. And you know, aggressively known for at least a decade. I mean, when I wrote Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight back in 1996, the first edition of it, yeah, I was quoting Nobel Prize-winning scientists, you know, absolute consensus statements signed by thousands of the top scientists in the world up against, you know, Fred Singer, up against, you know, one guy, or like four guys who were shills for industry, right? That for some reason the media is well, you got 2,000 credible scientists on the one hand, you got four shills for industry on the other. Let's give them equal time. The American media is so bizarre. I mean, they have completely lost the idea of being arbiters for the truth, of being the ones who say, you know, we're going to check out the facts and tell you what looks like it's really true and what's really nonsense. They've completely lost that, and they've become this. They become talk show hosts of bad television talk, you know, of Oprah type, not that Oprah's bad, but of Oprah type television shows, you know, badly done versions of Oprah. Let's have a guest on and be nice to them. And just let's try to get all sides of the story. Sometimes there's really not all sides. Sometimes, you know, it's pretty overwhelming that there's one side of the story. There really is global warming. And it really is changing the climate. And it really is producing mind-boggling changes in weather around the world, including droughts out west and floods and hurricanes and tornadoes down south. And this is what climate scientists have been predicting for decades. And here it is, folks. And I so wish... I don't know how to get it through. That when CBS, NBC, ABC, NPR... CNN, forget about faux news, do their reports on George Bush goes down to Florida to pass out a little money to all of his brother and all of that they add that these hurricanes brought on by global warming, the result of conservative fossil fuel industry friendly environmental policy, largely here in the United States, which consumes 25% of the world's fossil fuels, with 6% of the world's population, these policies have directly led to these hurricanes. I'm not hearing it. Are you? I'm not hearing it at all. Of course, elsewhere in the news last night, Georgie, as he was called back then, to differentiate him from George the father. They didn't call him George Jr., they called him Georgie. Got outed. Ben Barnes? Mr. Barnes, the former Speaker of the House of the great state of Texas, the Lone Star State of Texas, goes on 60 Minutes and says, well, I'm the guy who pulled the strings that got George into the National Guard when he was supposed to be drafted. Thus, our quote for the day from Colin Powell, 1995, he wrote an autobiography called My American Journey. At the time, of course, he was just retiring as one of the world's most famous generals, or one of the United States' most famous modern generals, let's say, with Desert Storm and all that. So he wrote an autobiography. And in it, he notes, and I quote, our quote for the day, I am angry that so many sons of the powerful and well-placed, and many professional athletes who were probably healthier than any of us, managed to wangle slots in reserve and National Guard units. Of the many tragedies of Vietnam, this raw class discrimination strikes me as the most damaging to the ideal that all Americans are created equal and owe equal allegiance to our country. Well, gee, you know, next thing you know, they'll be talking about the fact that the only way that Georgie got into Yale or Harvard was with legacy preference, string pull, whatever you want to call it, quotas, I mean, fill in the blank. What Republican buzzword do you want to apply to that, where you can get into the college because your parents went there or because your father gives $1 million to the university? Yeah, we'll get there. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, by the way. 1-866-889-8894. The chat room, alive and well. Our website, tomhartman.com. However you spell it, the real spelling, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, but however you spell it, you'll get there. We've got all the misspellings. They all point to the same place. Just click chat room. It'll drop you to the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. If you're not an AOL or if you are an AOL or CompuServe user, just plug in your screen name and password and boom, you're in. If you're not, you don't have to pay them anything. You don't have to give them a credit card. You do have to give them your email address. And it's not so that they can spam you. It's so that if you start spamming the forum or the chat room or whatever, they know how to lock somebody out. So it's not, you know, it's not a huge invasion of privacy kind of thing. It's just reasonable security. But anyhow, that's our chat room and interesting conversation there and good folks. 1-866-889-8894. A telephone number, Dave in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Dave, how you doing there?
Fine. How are you, Tom?
I'm alive and kicking.
All right. Yeah, me too.
What's up?
You know, first of all, talk about the news media being so bizarre. You know, it just seems to me that, you know, well, first of all, not everybody in Grand Rapids is conservative. I want to let your listeners know that.
Yeah, well, and that's true of all the, quote, conservative, end quote, parts of America. I mean, in most parts of the United States that are the so-called red states, you know, it's maybe a 5% majority, 10% at the 10% is huge, absolutely huge. So you're still talking 40% of the people, you know. Anyway.
Yeah.
You were saying.
Well, you know, talk about bizarre. I mean, when the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, quote unquote, came out and, you know, generated all this hoopla about John Kerry and everything else, it seemed like the media paid a lot of attention to it.
Oh, it was incredible. I remember seeing John O'Neill being interviewed on one of the shows, and the guy interviewing him, who was, you know, clueless, says, don't you have any association with Republicans? And O'Neill, who had been hired by Chuck Colson in 1972 and worked directly with Richard Nixon, coached directly by Richard Nixon, specifically for the purpose of going on television with specific character assassination against John Kerry, they hired him because he was also a Swift boat commander, not at the same time Kerry was, but right after Kerry, and that's why they hired him, that's why the Republicans hired him, to specifically attack Kerry and refute his charges. And this guy, who has contributed to the Republicans in virtually every election in the last two decades, the maximum legal limit, and to Republican candidates, we now know, with his, you know, blank-eating grin on his face, you know, says, "Oh no, I'm not partisan. I have no affiliation." It's like, yeah.
It's just like the guys that, you know, want to get Ralph Nader on the ballot in a lot of states. They're not partisan either, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Wink.
But they really gave O'Neill a pass for weeks.
Oh yeah,
for weeks.
And you know, what I'm getting at is, you know, just this morning, it came out about the former lieutenant governor of Texas. And, you know, you had talked about this on your show in previous broadcasts.
Yeah. It was on 60 Minutes last night.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's what I'm getting at. And, you know, talk about the news media here.
Yeah. Clueless.
Well, it comes out, and they're, like, downplaying it, saying, well, you know, why are we paying attention to this? Vietnam was...
Oh, I know. It's incredible. Last night, Chris Matthews says, we're not going to talk about this anymore. It happened 35 years ago. Yeah, great time to decide that, Chris. Dave, thanks for the call and pointing that. I absolutely agree. Spot on. Well said. 20 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. Stick around.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
The last hours of ancient sunlight, the fate of the world, and what we can do before it's too late is Tom Hartman's stunning wake-up call to humanity. Conversations with God author Neil Donald Walsh says this about the book.
Quote it everywhere. Buy 10 books and give them away. Don't let this action go unheard. You may feel like a voice in the wilderness, but it is your voice we're waiting to hear. Yours is the crucial vote. You are the determining factor. We reach critical mass when we reach you, and you choose to reach others with the simple message of this book. Let us act at last in the best interest of all. Then the sun will shine another day, and another still, and life will not merely go on, but achieve its highest expression, its grandest glory, its greatest joy. Can we give this gift to our children? Please say yes.
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Hey, California, where is your tax money going? To Walmart, of course. A new study released by UC Berkeley reveals that the low wages paid at Walmart stores forces employees to accept about $86 million annually in public assistance programs. That includes $32 million annually in health-related service and $54 million per year in services such as food stamps and subsidized housing. Walmart employees in that state earn on average 31% less than workers in the retail sector as a whole.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We got a president so bad, gotta be the worst we ever had.
Tom.
Got the job because of his dad. Now we're all in danger.
And we're all in debt. $1,450 a person.
Around, up to no good. Broke the old treaties cause he could. Struts all around like a hood. Got us in a world of trouble.
And welcome back. 24 minutes after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. If you take that $422 billion of debt that Georgie ran up this year and divide it by the 291 million men, women, and children in the United States, it comes out to $1,450 per person. And since it's been borrowed, well, you know what happens if you borrow, like, you know, you borrow $50,000 to buy a house. How much do you pay back over the course of the 20 or 30 year note? You pay back about twice that. You pay back $100,000. So your debt is really around $3,000. And that's per person. If you do it per worker, we got about 100 million workers in the United States. Because it's really the paychecks of the workers that are going to pay for it. I mean, it's not, you know, somebody's three-year-old child who's going to pay. Well, they will ultimately, but not right now. But even right now, we're having to pay interest on this stuff. So you do it by workers, you could just about triple that number. So it comes out to, what's that, around $4,500 that Georgie ran up in your name this year in debt. So that, and half of that debt was so that he could give tax cuts to rich people, $290 billion of it. And the other half of that debt was so he could have a war in Iraq, so that he could make himself a great wartime president, get reelected. If you look at the total deficit, $7,900 per person, and that's every man, woman, and child in America. That's $2.3 trillion. One out of every $5 that George Bush is spending right now has been borrowed. And this is a train wreck waiting to happen. And then he says he increased the economy. Well, yeah, okay, his tax cuts, which were roughly 10% of GDP, $1 trillion government stimulus, produced a 3% growth in GDP, as Elvis Knows shares with us. And therefore, as Daniel Gross mentioned, from the beginning of 2001 to the end of 2003, the economy added $1.31 or $1.317 trillion in gross domestic product and $4.2 trillion in debt. In other words, for every new dollar of economic output, George Bush gave us $3.19 in debt. I do not call that rational stimulus. 1-866-889-8894. Number Jay in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I am great.
I just have one comment. I've been watching this, like everybody else, watching this campaign, but I'm a little disturbed because Republicans seem to have the message down pat. You know, every time Kerry says something, they hold up their little shower talk and say, flip-flop, flip-flop. Yeah. Every time Kerry gets up there to rebut these charges, he goes into these long-winded awkward kind of constructions. And someone's got to teach this man, learn the soundbite.
Oh, I know. I know. He's talking Senate speak. And I have a feeling that he's irredeemable. You would think that he would have figured this out long ago, or that somebody on his campaign would have, you know, whack, whack, slapped him upside the head and said, hey.
Yeah, put a sock in his mouth.
Yeah.
The guy's got to learn that it's soundbites. We live in a soundbite generation. People were raised on Sesame Street with 30-second episodes. People won't listen to long-winded explanations. You got to say it quickly, and you got to say it cleverly. And if he doesn't get it, we're in deep weeds.
Yeah, I agree. Last night, Louise and I watched a 45-minute, hour-long, I don't know how long it was, tape called The Speeches of Franklin Roosevelt. It's just a videotape. You know, I bought it on Amazon or something. It's a and it's just a documentary piece. And it was just they just strung together from his very first campaign speech in 1932 all the way up to the speech just before he died, and right after VE Day and before VJ Day. And it was remarkable. The depth, the quality, the information, it just, you know, it wouldn't have worked today. I mean, that was true on the Republican side then as well. But frankly, I think we need the kind of discourse that Kerry has, but it's not what's going to get him elected.
No.
I absolutely agree with you, Dave. Or Jay, excuse me.
Thank you.
We need to slap this guy upside the head. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you and say, John, get with the program. But see, then you got to get all the other Democrats with the program, too. The Republicans do their daily talking points distribution, Fox News and all this, you know, with their daily The Memo. I don't see this. I'm not getting these things from the... I get them from the Republicans. I'm not getting them from the Dems. 29 minutes past the hour.
Tonight on NBC, the premiere of Must See TV Thursday with the most anticipated comedy of the year, Joey.
I thought you and Chandler should have moved out a long time ago. It's a very vibrant gay scene.
Chandler and I are not a gay couple.
You know you're going to check it out. Then... The Apprentice is back. New tasks, new competition. Same Donald.
You're fired.
Joey and the Apprentice, plus a sneak preview of Medical Investigation. NBC tonight.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Women who were dismissed from employment in the 1950s and early 60s for being married or pregnant may be one step closer to receiving long-denied pensions. On Tuesday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a group of women who say that Minnesota Power in Duluth discriminated against them by placing penalties on their pensions based on outdated gender rules. In the 50s and 60s, Minnesota Power had a policy that women employed with them who became married or pregnant were to be laid off. Many of the women were able to get their jobs back in the late 70s or early 80s, but when they retired, the company refused to count their first years of employment toward their pension. The ruling allows the women to proceed with their lawsuit. If the suit is won, it could set a precedent for millions of other women who faced similar discrimination decades ago and are now reaching retirement age.
Delta Airlines announced a major restructuring plan yesterday in an effort it says will allow the company to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline is closing its Dallas-Fort Worth hub, eliminating 7,000 jobs and 10% of its workforce. Also in the mix is an across-the-board wage cut for all employees, which Delta says is necessary due to increased competition and fuel prices. Older members of the pilots' union are threatening to retire early if Delta doesn't promise to protect their accrued benefits. Rick Aronson is a Boeing 757 pilot.
We're tired of jobs going overseas, and in the airline industry, we're afraid our pensions are going to be lost, and we're afraid that President Bush is going to allow foreign carriers to take our American airline jobs.
The airline industry overall is in crisis, with United Airlines having already filed for bankruptcy, and American and ATA have threatened bankruptcy.
When employees walked out of a Nestle USA plant in Freehold, New Jersey last month, attempting to get the company to sit down at the bargaining table, they were offered a Hobson's Choice. Accept the new company-wide health care program, or stay out on strike and lose their paychecks and benefits altogether. The workers said that it was the first time in that factory's history that the company has not allowed workers to negotiate where the cost of their benefits will go. In order to protect their jobs, the workers relented and returned to work. The strike was not necessarily about rising health care costs as much as it was about workers losing their voices in the company.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Cash-strapped parents are feeling the pinch as schools across the country increase the price of lunch due to rising costs. The average high school lunch costs about $1.66 and $1.43 for elementary school lunches. According to a recent survey by Education Week, price increases ranged anywhere from 30 cents in Atlanta to $1 in California. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Mary Jacoby. Mary Jacoby is the Washington correspondent for Salon.com and has done some just great reporting, absolutely great reporting. George W. Bush's missing year, Senator Graham Bush covered up Saudi involvement in 9/11, and others for Salon.com. And Mary Jacoby is our guest here on the program right now. Hey, Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
You talked with Jimmy Allison's wife, Linda. My guess is most of our listeners have never heard of Jimmy or Linda Allison. Bring us up to speed.
No, because Jimmy Allison died in 1978 when he was 46 years old. And he was, I guess, sort of equivalent to the Lee Atwater or the Jim Baker at the time of the Bush family.
The Karl Rove.
Trusted friend and confidant and political advisor.
Yeah, sort of the Karl Rove of the day.
Well, I don't know if anybody's in Karl Rove's category exactly, but
yeah, other than Machiavelli and Svengali, perhaps it's
right. Yeah,
yeah. So, Jimmy Allison, good friend of the Bush family, counselor to the Bush family. Jimmy Allison was the guy that George Herbert Walker Bush and his wife Barbara turned to when they were apparently having a problem with their 26-year-old son, George W.
That's right. According to Jimmy Allison's widow, Linda Allison, who spoke for the first time about this after 32 years, and what she told me was that contrary to the implication or the line coming out of the Bush campaign, which was that Bush transferred to Alabama, going from the Texas Air National Guard to the Alabama National Guard because he had such a great opportunity to work on this Senate campaign. Well, in fact, according to Linda Allison, he was there because he was partying too hard, becoming an embarrassment to the family in Houston, and that George H.W. Bush asked his friend Jimmy Allison, please, can you take him under your wing and get him out of Houston?
Yeah, he's... Too many. I'm wondering, are you familiar with Mr. Hatfield's book, Fortunate Son, and his allegations that George W. had been arrested for cocaine, and that's why he did that 30 days of community service in the inner city there in Houston?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the allegation. I'm not sure it's ever quite been proved with paper trail or anything.
Yeah, no, Hatfield claimed that he had the proof, that he had three witnesses, that he had the transcripts,
yeah.
And then he showed up dead a few months later in a hotel room. I'm just wondering if his allegations were right around that time period. Do you know?
Yes, they were. And this is, and I'm just be clear here, this is speculation, but it's kind of interesting. It sort of fits into what Linda Allison and others have told me about his partying at the time. There is speculation, and it's not been proved, but that George Bush, his father asked him to go into a program work at a program for inner city children in Houston called PUL. And this occurred in maybe December or late 1972 after he had come home drunk one night. And this is an incident that the Bush family has acknowledged. Come home drunk one night in December 72 in visiting his parents in Washington shortly after this campaign ended in Alabama. And he hit a garbage can as he was driving and dragged it down the street and got into a fight with his father and challenged him to go, quote, mano a mano.
Yeah.
And, the speculation is that perhaps if this arrest did occur, which, again, there's no real proof that it did, that the reason he went into this program for inner city children was some sort of community service.
Right. And
that's really just speculation.
Yeah, and the reason it's really just speculation is because when he became governor, all of his records, all of his previous records, so completely vanished from all of the computers and all the files of the entire state of Texas that he had to have a new driver's license issued with a new driver's license number.
Well, that's another recurring theme here is the vanishing documents in all aspects of this story of George W. Bush's life. And we've seen it this week. It is 60 Minutes last evening, aired this interview with the former House Speaker in Texas, Ben Barnes, who was Lieutenant Governor, and says that he, at the request of a Bush family friend, pulled strings to get Bush into the Guard, which would have kept him from active combat duty. And 60 Minutes found these documents that had disappeared from the personal file of the squadron commander in Texas at the time.
Right.
And they were a series of memos to himself saying, I'm under a lot of political pressure to fix, cook the books, fix the record here, sugarcoat my evaluations for George W. Bush.
Yeah, in fact, he titled one of his memos CYA.
CYA, exactly.
As in your own. And so when you were talking with Allison, Linda Allison, Mrs.
Linda Allison,
she confirmed for you that not only were they involved in this thing of getting Bush into this campaign that he was her husband was running in Alabama, but that she had never seen George Bush in uniform during the time that they were now. Didn't even know he was supposed to be in the National Guard. And that he also had a particular way of showing up at the campaign headquarters on those days when he did.
Right, and she wasn't the only one who told me this. I had quoted another person who'd worked on the campaign at the time. And other people told me this off the record. She never saw him in a uniform. Not that she would necessarily know, but she never even heard him mention guard duty. She said, did you have any idea that he was involved in the guard? She said, oh, good Lord, no.
Yeah.
And not only that, but he, according to numerous sources, showed up late around noon every day at the campaign, appeared to have been partying hard the night before, boasting about it even, and would leave early. And in fact, one of the people I interviewed is now a lawyer in Charlotte, North Carolina, said that Jimmy Allison, the campaign manager, came and quietly asked him to take over George's duties because they weren't getting done.
In a way, it's sort of consistent with the fact that George W. Bush has taken more presidential vacation days than any president in the history of the United States.
A lot of presidents take some time off. I mean,
this has been almost 40% of his entire presidency.
Well, I don't know the figures on that,
yeah.
But there was clearly a pattern at that period of him shirking his duties, or at least not being extremely conscientious about it. And what Linda Allison told me flushes out the picture of what is being called Bush's lost year.
Yeah.
And what was he doing in Alabama? And there's the whole other controversy over whether he fulfilled his duties at the Guard in Alabama. And, it's increasingly evident that apparently he didn't.
Now, C. Murphy Archibald, who was a nephew of Red Blount's by marriage, shared some observations with you about this as well?
Yes, he did. And he's the one who Jimmy Allison came and asked. He said, look, look, these packets of information to the county chairman for our campaign is some crucial campaign issue. They're not getting sent out, and it's hurting the candidate. Would you do this for me? And without saying, George is slacking off, but that was George's duties.
Yeah.
I call him George because everyone at the time called him Georgie, and that's how he was known.
Right. That was the way of differentiating him from George Sr.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're talking with Linda Jacoby, the Washington correspondent for Salon.
No, Mary Jacoby.
Oh, Mary, I'm sorry.
That's all
right. I was just looking at Linda Allison's name there as I was
right.
saying yours. I'm sorry. It's miswiring of the brain here. Mary Jacoby of Salon.com, thank you for catching that. Sometimes people just let that stuff go by. Anyhow, one of the things that I thought was fascinating in this piece that you did for Salon.com on Georgie's lost years in Alabama was why it was that Blount, if I'm pronouncing it right, or was it pronounced
Blount?
Blount, B-L-O-U-N-T, but Blount,
right.
lost. He lost to the Democrat Sparkman in 72. And it was because he did something very similar to what the George W. Bush campaign did against John McCain in 2000. And I suppose you could say even kind of similar to the Swift Boat thing. Tell us the story of that.
Well, also similar to what Lee Atwater piggybacked on in the
Dukakis campaign.
The 88 campaign, the Willie Horton ad.
Yeah.
That's probably the even the better analogy.
Because there's a racial thing to it. Yeah.
This was the South in the early 70s, and the Blunt campaign had edited a radio interview that their opponent, the incumbent Democrat John Sparkman, had given to make it appear as if he supported busing of students, which was really not a popular position at that time.
Death to a politician.
Southerners.
Yeah.
And when the Sparkman campaign found an edited, an unedited version of this and distributed that, then it, they ended up winning.
Yeah. Do you think that that's because back in those days, the media actually reported the story? I mean, they actually followed through. Hey, here's what really was said.
I actually think the media was probably less tough back then.
Really?
There's been, that's a whole other discussion, but, and I think that it's taken some time for the mainstream newspapers to get onto this story about Alabama and the National Guard, but they're on it now.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the circumstances of that. I do know, though, that the trick was exposed, and Blunt went on to lose the election.
Yeah. It would be interesting to go back and look. I mean, just broadly, I was a reporter in 1972.
Oh, really?
In Michigan, and radio news. And we actually, I mean, that was back in the days when radio stations actually hired people to just go out and report the news. And, I'd go and interview the mayor and interview people. It was in the state capitol and never got any leaning on me of any sort from station management. The news was treated as sacred and sacrosanct. It was the news. It was really a very different era than it is now. But
well, yes, yeah, you might have a point. Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, you've got here Allison, Linda Allison, remembering encountering George W. Bush in a parking lot after Blunt loses the election as a consequence of being outed for falsely editing this interview that Sparkman did on the radio. What her recollection of running into George, what was that?
Well, she and her husband were walking to their car in the parking lot, and she said, I heard a noise behind me. It didn't sound quite right, and I looked back, and I saw Georgie urinating on a car. And then later that evening, apparently the cops were called, and he had an altercation with them and yelled at the cops. But I think that nothing ever came of that. That sort of seemed to be the pattern with him was being bailed out or not facing the consequences of some of his actions.
Yeah. We're talking with Mary Jacoby, the Washington correspondent for Salon.com. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, by the way, if you have any questions for Mary. And finally, when he left Montgomery, he left his apartment. It's funny, when the Bush administration got replaced by the Clinton administration, when Bill Clinton got elected, and George Herbert Walker Bush got a smaller percentage of the electoral vote than anybody since 1912. And yet people refer to the Reagan landslide. Nobody talks about the Clinton landslide. But in any case, and the Bushes were leaving office. There were these stories planted in the media that the This is the new one. This was when Clinton was leaving office and Bush was coming in. There were stories planted in the media that the Clinton folks had trashed furniture. Turns out none of these were true.
They had taken the W off of the keyboards for the computers and things
And these were just
things.
These were just lies.
This turned out not to be true.
Yeah, just lies planted by
well,
somebody,
yeah, apparently. The interesting thing is that, as you pointed out, the Birmingham News went and tracked down the family that rented their cottage to George W. Bush in that period in 72 in Montgomery, and he told the newspaper that it was completely trashed.
Yeah.
The chandelier had been pulled off, the holes in the wall, the furniture destroyed, and that they sent George W. Bush a bill for the repairs, but he never responded.
Yeah. It's sort of the way, the echo that I got when I read this was the way that we've been treating Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, it's just, you know, trash their country, and there's a mentality there that's a little strange, a little unfortunate, a little scary, frankly.
And I think, the news value of this, in addition to the fact that John Kerry's record in the same time period when he was in Vietnam volunteering for combat has been questioned, but also the relevance of this is experience and judgment, and what experience and judgment the commander-in-chief has when he sends people over or starts a war. Here's somebody who's never really had to face up to consequences and doesn't really understand what it's like for people who don't have connections and don't get to have their daddy bail them out.
And
doesn't seem to have real empathy for that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's quite clear to me that he still doesn't, and it may well simply be that he's never had contact with it in a way that's real and meaningful. A fellow I interviewed for a book I was writing once told me the story about how when he, this was right after the Orange Bowl thing in Florida where Bobby Kennedy and Jack, you know, where they bailed out the Bay of Cuba guys, the Bay of Pigs guys in Cuba. And this was Harry Enrique Ruiz Williams was the guy who told me the story. He and Bobby Kennedy were walking in I believe it was Orlando, about 2 o'clock in the morning, along with a third guy who was an African-American who was also, he was the number two guy in the Bay of Pigs command. And they went into a restaurant, and the waitress came over and threw them out because they had a black guy with them. And Bobby Kennedy went ballistic. He was, and she was like, I'm the Attorney General of the United States. She was like, I don't care if you're God. We don't serve. And he had never in his life encountered that. And Harry said that was a turning point for him. That was when he really got serious about civil rights and things. And I don't think that George W. has ever had that kind of a confrontation. Anyhow, a remarkable bit of writing here you've done. One just last, well, I think we're just about out of time here, but George W. riding a bicycle slowly in front of his mother when he's 26 years old. This was right after the unsuccessful.
Yeah, this was sort of a glimpse into this angry, troubled relationship with the family at the time. And apparently, you know, Linda Allison said she didn't know what happened, but apparently the son was furious at the mother, and the mother was trying to drive to the local beach club for lunch.
I've got to wrap it up there, Mary. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's a great story. You can read it. George W. Bush's Missing Year on Salon.com. Mary Jacoby, thank you very much, Mary, for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When human rights groups discover that our third world sweatshops employ a lot of child labor, they're always horrified. These children should be in school, they stridently insist. But why would these kids be better off sitting at a desk learning about social studies than working on our assembly lines? Schools are supposed to prepare you for the future. In most of the places we do business, the only future these moppets have is on an assembly line. What better way for them to prepare than in our sweatshop apprentice program? The kids get paid a special introductory wage while they learn all the skills they'll need for the rest of their short, miserable lives. And those little hands can do some really intricate stitching, believe me. This has been Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaires!
Hi, this is Tom Hartmann. It's been said that if you scratch the surface of any issue of social or economic injustice, you'll find the issue of corporate power and corporate personhood. Join me for the facts. on September 24th. I'll be speaking in Portland, Oregon at the Unitarian Church on Main Street at 7 p.m. For more information, call Marcia at 503-665-3957. That's 503-665-3957.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
An enormous fire in Yellowstone was a public relations disaster for the National Park Service, but it was business as usual for nature. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. The National Park Service enacted a new policy in 1972. It would let wildfires burn unless they threatened unique features or buildings in the parks. For the first 15 years, the strategy worked well, but everything changed in the summer of 1988. Fires swept through drought-stricken Yellowstone National Park, ultimately burning about 36% of the park, almost 800,000 acres. Linda Wallace is the editor of a new book called After the Fires. Wallace says heavy media coverage of the Yellowstone fires missed the mark.
The media, for the most part, is trained to cover what they call disaster stories. And in a disaster story, you have to have a victim. In a natural ecosystem where fire is a natural process, it is a victimless process. So the media ended up making up victims or choosing a victim. Now, there were some people whose houses were burned by the fires, and they are definitely victims. But for the most part, the ecosystem was helped by these fires rather than harmed, and that was a story that didn't come across well.
Wallace says the media described the fires with terms like destruction.
The term destruction is definitely an inappropriate term to apply to natural wildfires in a natural ecosystem. The ecosystem depends upon fire, and when you don't have fire, that is actually more of a destructive process than having a fire burn in a fire-maintained ecosystem.
Wallace says the 1988 fires were not even unique. Studies of sediment layers and other historical evidence revealed past fires of similar size. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You can stir with a stick, free Teflon, whitewashed presidency. We're sick of being jerked around with it on your sleeve.
And welcome back. I'm reading the chat room here, and it's like, whoa, you're really interesting. You're just going to have to find out for yourself. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It's stuff I can't talk about on the radio. Anyway, welcome back to our program. 4 minutes before the hour, job cuts announced by U.S. companies increased 6.6% in August to 74,150. You will recall that the Bush administration, a little less than a year ago, decided to suspend the annual mass layoffs reporting that historically had been done by the Labor Department. It had only been suspended once before since the creation of the Labor Department back during the Great Depression. And that was under the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush. And when Bill Clinton came back into power, he reinstated the mass layoffs reports. The mass layoffs reports were, you know, basically where the Labor Department was, you know, going around, looking around and saying, you know, who's being laid off in quantities larger than 1,000 people at a whack, and let's compile that. Rather than just looking at unemployment statistics, you look for trends. And, you know, it might be, in many cases, this would produce very useful information that could help guide policy. But it was also during the Reagan-Bush recession, and during the George W. Bush recession, politically embarrassing. So what's happened is that the news agencies have figured out how to simply compile the statistics that are, you know, scattered all over the place and assemble this stuff on their own. Thus, now, for the first time in about a year, we have these kinds of reports here. Layoff announcements have settled to a range between 65 and 75,000 per month in 2004, after averaging just over 100,000 a month in 2003. This is the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas is organized this information. They point out that financial services firms cut 13,153 jobs in August. Diversified services cut 6,340. Retail, telecommunications, industrial, and computer firms cut more than 5,000. 12-month average fell to 88,100, down from 88,500. The good news, I suppose, John Challenger, the CEO of the outplacement firm, he says it appears that job cut activity is holding steady in the 60 to 70,000 range. That's jobs cut per month. That's absolutely remarkable. And in the meantime, we are all now $1,500 apiece deeper in debt, thanks to George W. Just for this last year. This is the Tom Hartman Program, The True People's Radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy. Again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a direct TV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room direct TV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my direct TV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546. Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Women who were dismissed from employment in the 1950s and early 60s for being married or pregnant may be one step closer to receiving long-denied pensions. On Tuesday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a group of women who say that Minnesota Power in Duluth discriminated against them by placing penalties on their pensions based on outdated gender rules. In the 50s and 60s, Minnesota Power had a policy that women employed with them who became married or pregnant were to be laid off. Many of the women were able to get their jobs back in the late 70s or early 80s, but when they retired, the company refused to count their first years of employment toward their pension. The ruling allows the women to proceed with their lawsuit. If the suit is won, it could set a precedent for millions of other women who faced similar discrimination decades ago and are now reaching retirement age.
Delta Airlines announced a major restructuring plan yesterday in an effort it says will allow the company to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline is closing its Dallas-Fort Worth hub, eliminating 7,000 jobs and 10% of its workforce. Also in the mix is an across-the-board wage cut for all employees, which Delta says is necessary due to increased competition and fuel prices. Older members of the pilots' union are threatening to retire early if Delta doesn't promise to protect their accrued benefits. Rick Aronson is a Boeing 757 pilot.
We're tired of jobs going overseas, and in the airline industry, we're afraid our pensions are going to be lost, and we're afraid that President Bush is going to allow foreign carriers to take our American airline jobs.
The airline industry overall is in crisis, with United Airlines having already filed for bankruptcy, and American and ATA have threatened bankruptcy.
When employees walked out of a Nestle USA plant in Freehold, New Jersey last month, attempting to get the company to sit down at the bargaining table, they were offered a Hobson's choice: accept the new company-wide health care program or stay out on strike and lose their paychecks and benefits altogether. The workers said that it was the first time in that factory's history that the company has not allowed workers to negotiate where the cost of their benefits will go. In order to protect their jobs, the workers relented and returned to work. The strike was not necessarily about rising health care costs as much as it was about workers losing their voices in the company.
Here's today's Del Bob Report. Cash-strapped parents are feeling the pinch as schools across the country increase the price of lunch due to rising costs. The average high school lunch costs about $1.66 and $1.43 for elementary school lunches. According to a recent survey by Education Week, price increases ranged anywhere from 30 cents in Atlanta to $1 in California. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
After 9/11, there was a headline on a French paper, "Today We Are All Americans." We had the world on our side in a way that hasn't been seen since post-World War II. Within, you know, a few months after that, with the obsession with Iraq, it was washed away. I was a registered Republican. Now I'm a Democrat, and I'm voting for John Kerry in November.
Move On PAC is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
In a moment of theological reflection, Woody Allen once declared, "I believe there is something out there watching us. Unfortunately, it's the government." Woody's little joke has become today's chilling reality as the Bush-Ashcroft regime has imposed measure after measure of new autocratic police power to keep watch over we the people. All of this has been done under the guise of fighting terrorists, but the government's focus increasingly is shifting from them to us. The latest example is the FBI's heavy-handed push to harass, intimidate, and suppress ordinary citizens who seek to protest governmental or corporate policies. Prior to the national conventions of both the Republican and Democratic parties, the so-called Justice Department dispatched federal agents to at least six states to trail and grill potential protesters. As one young protester put it, the government agents were trying to, quote, "let us know that, hey, we're watching you." This repressive knock on the door by authorities is not merely directed at targets known to be plotting criminal activity, but at citizens who were simply planning to attend legitimate protests. Ashcroft himself asserts that these people might, perhaps, possibly could have the potential to do something criminal, or that they might, perhaps, possibly could know someone who could do so. The Justice Department's infamous Office of Legal Policy okayed this vague, big brotherish assault on our individual liberty by declaring that any chilling of the right to dissent would be outweighed by the need for order. Of course, bullying autocrats have always donned the dark cloak of order to rationalize their repression. The Bush-Ashcroft use of FBI snoops to intimidate today's dissenters is not about preventing crime, but about preventing protest. This is Jim Hightower saying, to protest their crude attempt to lock down protest, call the ACLU, 212-549-2500.
Hi, my name is Sophie. For 5 years, I lived alone in this big house Joe and I built 35 years ago. Our girls grew up in this house. They visited every couple of weeks, and I loved seeing my grandkids, but most of the time I was on my own. Some days I didn't even go out. I just felt sad. Lonely, I guess. One day my daughter came over and said, "Get your coat, Mom. We're going for a drive." She wouldn't tell me where. When we got to the ASPCA, I got nervous. But once I met little Stevie, everything changed. Stevie's my cat. It's hard to express what a difference little Stevie's made in my life. It's mostly small things, like hearing his ridiculously loud purr. Stevie brought love back into my house. I may have saved his life, I don't know. But I do know that he made mine a lot brighter.
This is Richard Thompson, member of the board of directors of the ASPCA, encouraging you to visit your local animal shelter and adopt a cat.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the good news is John Kerry wins in a landslide, an absolute landslide. The bad news is the poll was done internationally. Only 1 in 5 people surveyed around the world support the re-election of George W. Bush, according to the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. Hey, welcome back to the program, my friends. 7 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the middle of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Our number, 1-866-889-8894. You want to drop into the chat room, TomHartman.com. We'll get you there. Just link on the chat room link. Or if you want to drop into the message boards and post something for posterity, pick a fight, make a comment. There's a few fights get picked. Anyhow, just click on the message board link. Here's this poll. It was a poll of people from all regions of the world. The Program on International Policy Attitudes did. They apparently do these things fairly regularly. 32 countries, all regions of the world, it must mean, all 5 continents, prefer Kerry to Bush. Kerry won clear majorities in China, Indonesia, and Japan, but slipped past Bush by only a slight margin in Thailand and India, writes Thomas Crampton in the International Herald Tribune, article titled, Global Poll Shows a Kerry Landslide. France, Germany, and Mexico, 80% of those surveyed thought the foreign policies of George W. Bush made them feel worse about the United States. Most traditional U.S. allies came out strongly favoring Kerry, while only those polled in Nigeria, that nation where the oil-drunk barons of the country put to death the local indigenous protesters, who were a little concerned about the way that Shell was doing business there. Poland, our great ally in the war in Iraq, they've contributed nearly 400 troops, I think, one of the more substantial numbers. And the Philippines, who have since pulled out, preferred Bush. Mr. Cull, where's his first name here? Anyhow, this Steve Cull, director of the program. Steve Cull says, even where the president does beat John Kerry, there's no enthusiasm apparent from the numbers. Those countries that support him for re-election also tend not to like his foreign policy. Well, what about the people who are closest to us, the people who pay the closest attention to American domestic politics and who have probably the largest stake in this thing, the Canadians? They share the largest contiguous border with any country that shares with any country in the world, essentially non-defended border. They are, as I recall, our number one trading partner. At least they certainly were before NAFTA and Mexico got into the act. I'm pretty sure they still are our largest single trading partner. And probably the only country in the world where much American television and radio is actually accessible to probably the majority of the country. Most of Canada lives in cities that are along the southern border, other than Fox News, which the Canadians have aggressively tried to keep out. Anyhow, in Canada, what do the Canadians think about this? Some relatively disinterested observers, right? They have no dog in this fight. It's, in Canada, 16% of Canadians think that George W. Bush should get reelected or get elected or reselected, something. 61% favor John Kerry. I would call that decisive. Another country that has, pretty close ties to us and a lot on the board, as it were, in the game, Great Britain. Prime Minister Tony Blair, known domestically as Toady Blair, Bush's poodle, has been the foreign leader most closely allied to U.S. policy, in Iraq anyway, writes Thomas Crampton. 16%, very similar results, 16% of Brits are in favor of Bush. 47% prefer Kerry. So there's apparently a fairly substantial number of undecideds, which I suppose, or simply, we're British, we're reserved, we're not sharing our opinions with you. Thank you. Could be. Who knows? I don't know. I salute, by the way, British Reserve. I didn't mean that as a slam. I always thought we could use a little more of that here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. 7 out of 10 Americans, this survey also found, domestically, here in the United States, 7 out of 10 Americans are concerned about the fact that 4 out of 5 foreigners look upon us poorly now, purely as a result of George W. Bush's foreign policy, specifically attacking a country that represented no threat to us, had no weapons, was under United Nations sanctions, was allowing in UN inspectors, and now, you know, we're in the middle of this prolonged and protracted guerrilla war, Vietnam all over again. 7 out of 10, 70% of Americans are worried about what the rest of the world thinks of us. And guess what? Here's what the rest of the world thinks of us. They think we are being led by a schmuck. That's being charitable. I want to get into what might World War III look like, speaking of George W., in just a moment. Let's take a call, though. 1-866-889-8894. Our number, Jeff in Denver on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. It was interesting you went over that poll again because I thought it was most interesting how our neighbors are the ones who seem to like us the least. Maybe the Canadians 4-1 going for Kerry.
Well, they and the Canadians like us the most, I would
well,
say.
Well, I should
you know,
say
Bush the least, yeah.
Yes,
Bush is not us.
Yeah, corrected.
Thank you.
Important thing, you keep mentioning this thing about the deficit and our debt.
Yeah.
And one thing we've mentioned before in the show is that's actually probably not a correct number. It's probably worse than that because they leave off the Social Security borrowing.
$200 billion this year. They just said, gee, our deficit this year is only going to be $440 billion more or less. And they are ignoring the fact that the Bush administration spent a more than $200 billion surplus that the Social Security Trust Fund accumulated this year. And so the real deficit is over 600, as you correctly point out, close to $700 billion.
Yeah, so each year it's usually 20 to 50% bigger than they say it is. So our debt is actually much higher.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on from year to year. Clinton, during the Clinton administration, one of those years, there actually was enough of a surplus. I believe it was the very last year, but it might have been the next to the last year. I'd have to go back and look at them. There was enough of a so-called surplus to actually mean that they didn't have to raid Social Security to say that there was a surplus. But some of the Clinton surpluses were actually phony numbers because they, too, were counting Social Security as part of general funds, which it shouldn't be counted as.
Yes.
Although Clinton actually did have a genuine surplus one year, it would have been much smaller. It would have been $200 billion more or less smaller, or almost $300 billion, I think, back in that year. That's what Al Gore kept ranting about in the debates. And we got to put Social Security in a lockbox, and Americans are going, what's he talking about? You know, it's like the average person just doesn't have a clue that the Clinton administration had been doing it, the Bush administration before that. We really started big time with the Reagan administration, refiguring how those figurings are done and reporting the deficits and the debts and all that sort of thing. Absolutely, spot on right.
And there's also there will be more Iraq money than is reported. So.
Yeah,
that
Iraq is going to cost more. Plus, they're also the Medicare program, in at least in past years, has generated a modest surplus. I think this year it's they're trying to run it at parity. You know, so the outflow equals the inflow, which is why they had to raise the rates, in part. I mean, they had to raise the rates obviously because medical care is skyrocketing, the cost of medical care. But there has been even a surplus in that program in the past that has been spent as general funds. So. Yeah, it's a strange one. It's a strange one, Jeff.
Just be nice if we could be honest for once.
Yeah. Well, So, you know, some of us are talking about this stuff, and I know you're out there doing it, too, and I congratulate you and honor you for that and wish you the best in continuing to do the same. Jeff,
okay,
thanks
good luck to us all, Tom.
You betcha. Thanks, Jeff. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. I do want to get into this thing with Chechnya. I think that this is the big story that's not being talked about, and it's not being talked about because, A, people don't understand it, and, B, there is the American press, there is a faction within the United States that wants to position this story in a particular way, and they've been successful with the press. We'll get to that in just a second. Kate in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Kate, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'm just thinking that if the poll saying that the majority of the people in the world would vote for Kerry instead of Bush, I'm wondering if doesn't it just logically follow then that the same is true in this country? And that we're just being fed really phony polls, poll information?
Well, I mean, you know, I would say yes, except for the fact that the rest of the world gets different news than we get.
Ooh, that's true. Didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, and the rest of the world doesn't listen to, you know, 300-400 hours a day of, in aggregate, of right-wing talk radio.
Okay.
The rest of the world doesn't have Fox News.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Oh, I hope we're not that gullible and that much of a nation of sheep.
We will find out on November 2nd,
yes,
won't we?
We will. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Bye now. Yeah, okay. So this is the story that, you know, I want to just spend a little bit of time with this because you need to know about this. If there is going to be a world war in our lifetimes, this situation is the canary in the mine shaft. And in my opinion, that world war, which I see as a very distinct possibility and something that we could head off if we had decent leadership in the White House right now, and clearly we don't, yesterday, and that world war is going to not involve Palestine versus Israel, as so many of George Bush's good friends, the evangelists awaiting the rapture, think, or, you know, the Middle Eastern Arabs against the rest of the world. It's not going to be the Christians against the Muslims. It's going to be the United States of America, the last standing empire, against China and Russia, two former empires that would like to be empires again, and who are on the continent that's attached to Europe, and who are contiguous with the Middle East, and who do need this oil. Russia, I suppose you could say, has a net surplus. China has a net deficit. And we have been, a group of people in the United States has been supporting the folks in Chechnya, and the Russians are just absolutely rip-roaring furious about this. Now, I want to talk about this for just a few minutes right after this break without getting into value judgments about it. I mean, I'll share my opinions on the issue. But just looking at it from the point of view of the Russians, how their perspective on this thing, and which is not being reported in the American press, or not well enough that the average person gets it, and you will see how dangerous the situation is, particularly given that country has some 7,000 nuclear missiles pointed at us right now, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channels?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a four-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month for second and each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call now.
Tonight on NBC, the premiere of Must See TV Thursday with the most anticipated comedy of the year, Joey.
I thought you and Chandler should have moved out a long time ago. It's very vibrant gay scene.
Chandler and I are not a gay couple.
You know you're going to check it out. Then, The Apprentice is back. New tasks, new competition. Same Donald.
You're fired.
Joey and The Apprentice, plus a sneak preview of Medical Investigation. NBC tonight.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Due to the rising rate of overweight Americans, more hospitals are being forced to spend money on patient lift systems and specialized hospital beds and wheelchairs. The U.S. Center of Disease Control reports that 65% of American adults are overweight and 31% are obese. SizeWise Rentals, whom specializes in medical equipment for the obese, has reported its business growing 15 to 20% each year.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Give a small child a knife, and the poor tyke is likely to chop off a finger. But in the hands of a master chef, that knife is a tool for creating a sumptuous feast. It's the same thing with money. Give money to poor people, and they'll probably squander it on foolish indulgences like aluminum siding or medicine or food. But if you put money in our hands, in the hands of people who have been around money all our lives, we're going to build empires and buy elections and develop weapon systems and suppress dissent and spread the blessing that is the essence of what America is all about. Unbridled corporate freedom all over the world. I'm Zena Fobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here comes the billionaire!
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, I remember this one.
Oh, I think we're just too stupid for democracy.
No.
Whoever thought majority should rule.
I still think it's a good idea.
We're just too stupid for democracy. Show me a mirror, I'll show you a fool.
No. I am not that cynical. I'm sorry. I'm just not that cynical. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Chechnya. There is a group of folks in the United States, and this is what Putin was talking about. A couple of days ago, it was either yesterday or the day before, Vladimir Putin maybe I should share a little more in a little more background. I've been to Russia a few times. The last time I was there, not the last time, but one of the last times I was there. And in fact, I've got hanging on my wall an article that Pravda did about me last year. But anyhow, in Cyrillic, I can't read it, but it looks cool. In any case, I wrote in a book called The Prophet's Way about when I was there during the first elections to have been held in the thousand-year history of Russia. And this was, I don't know, it must have been about eight or ten years? I'm not sure when it was. Anyway, I'd have to go back and look. But you know what I'm talking about. This was Yeltsin was running, and Vladimir Zhirinovsky was running against him. And Zhirinovsky was this right-winger, and I was staying with a Russian family. and the wife of the family spoke German, and I spoke, and I speak German, and so that's how we communicated. And so we're sitting there watching this guy, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, on TV, and he's giving this fiery speech. He's, waving his fists around and stuff like this, and he's just a fire and brimstone. He's this super right-wing nationalist guy. And then she and her husband both break out laughing. And so I asked her in German, I said, what are you laughing about? And she said, he just said, and just as she's saying this, they flip, the TV screen flips to this man and woman commentators, news commentators, in front of a what looked like a bad 1950s TV set, local TV station kind of set, with a cardboard or a plywood cut out of the world behind them, behind the desk and the whole bit. And they're talking to each other, and the very serious discussion they're having. And she said, he just said that anybody who votes for him, after the election, if he wins, he will give them a liter of vodka and a turkey. And these two commentators are having this very serious discussion, and the gist of the discussion is, where's he going to get all that, all those turkeys from? We know he can get the vodka, but where's he going to get the turkeys from? But they were taking this very seriously, because the Russians were figuring out democracy. They hadn't figured it out yet, but this was their first try. This was about a decade ago. And so, anyhow, Putin, in my opinion, is somebody who is a little more concerned with the survival of the republic than the survival of democracy, which is that's an arguable thing. Sometimes I suppose you could argue that those kind of decisions have to be made. But in any case, without getting into that either, because this is stuff, again, that I think is not any of our business. We've got this group, Elliot Abrams, who's on Bush's National Security Council, Ken Adelman, who was in the State Department under Reagan, Tom Keene, who's the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, William Kristol, who was the publisher of the editor of the Weekly Standard, Richard Perle, the Dark Prince, Pentagon, former Secretary Caspar Weinberger, and James Woolsey, who's the former CIA director, who's a shill for the oil companies, who loves to go on TV talking about the wonders of attacking the Middle East. These guys have set up this group called the American Committee for Peace in Chechnya. And they're saying to Putin, they're saying to the Russians, you should be negotiating with these people. These people who just, blew up a school. And Putin is saying to them, wait a minute. You don't want me to tell you to go negotiate with Osama bin Laden. Why are you telling me to negotiate with these guys? And he's getting really steamed. This is a bad situation. 29 minutes past the hour. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Women who were dismissed from employment in the 1950s and early 60s for being married or pregnant may be one step closer to receiving long-denied pensions. On Tuesday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a group of women who say that Minnesota Power and Duluth discriminated against them by placing penalties on their pensions based on outdated gender rules. In the 50s and 60s, Minnesota Power had a policy that women employed with them who became married or pregnant were to be laid off. Many of the women were able to get their jobs back in the late 70s or early 80s, but when they retired, the company refused to count their first years of employment toward their pension. The ruling allows the women to proceed with their lawsuit. If the suit is won, it could set a precedent for millions of other women who faced similar discrimination decades ago and are now reaching retirement age.
Delta Airlines announced a major restructuring plan yesterday in an effort it says will allow the company to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline is closing its Dallas-Fort Worth hub, eliminating 7,000 jobs and 10% of its workforce. Also in the mix is an across-the-board wage cut for all employees, which Delta says is necessary due to increased competition and fuel prices. Older members of the pilots' union are threatening to retire early if Delta doesn't promise to protect their accrued benefits. Rick Aronson is a Boeing 757 pilot.
We're tired of jobs going overseas, and in the airline industry, we're afraid our pensions are going to be lost, and we're afraid that President Bush is going to allow foreign carriers to take our American airline jobs.
The airline industry overall is in crisis, with United Airlines having already filed for bankruptcy, and American and ATA have threatened bankruptcy.
When employees walked out of a Nestle USA plant in Freehold, New Jersey last month, attempting to get the company to sit down at the bargaining table, they were offered a Hobson's choice: accept the new company-wide health care program or stay out on strike and lose their paychecks and benefits altogether. The workers said that it was the first time in that factory's history that the company has not allowed workers to negotiate where the cost of their benefits will go. In order to protect their jobs, the workers relented and returned to work. The strike was not necessarily about rising health care costs as much as it was about workers losing their voices in the company.
Here's today's Dal Bob Report. Cash-strapped parents are feeling the pinch as schools across the country increase the price of lunch due to rising costs. The average high school lunch costs about $1.66 and $1.43 for elementary school lunches. According to a recent survey by Education Week, price increases ranged anywhere from 30 cents in Atlanta to $1 in California. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. People who had gathered to mark the first day of school were herded into the gym by the militants. This from CBS News, Dateline Moscow. Some of whom voiced objections to seizing a school. Some of these militants, right? Some of these terrorists, some of these Chechen separatists, what do you want to call them? See, that's one of the problems here. Some of these guys who took over the school actually objected to taking over a school. Specifically, a fellow by the name of that's the colonel. Specifically two of the women who were participants in taking out this school. Okay. Here's the story. Detainee Nur Pashi Kuryalev is one of the people who was in the school. Told CBS News that the group's leader, who went by the name of Colonel, shot one of the militants and said he would do the same to any other militants or hostages who did not show unconditional obedience. Later that day, he detonated the explosives worn by two female attackers, killing them in order to enforce the lesson. One of the militants was stationed with his foot on a button that would set off the explosive. These explosives they had hanging all around the school gymnasium. If he lifted his foot, the bomb strung around the school gymnasium would detonate. Now, we have taken the position in the United States, we've taken this moral position that we're not going to negotiate with terrorists, that when somebody stoops to the level of using terrorism as a tactic to get our attention or to try and get something from us, we're not going to give at all. And in fact, we've even taken it a step further that we are going to hunt them down and kill them. These folks just took this school out. These were children. And their mothers, by and large. It was the first day of school, and their parents had, you know, had walked these kids to school. That's how they got over 1,000 people in this school. And in the same week, they had two airliners blown out of the sky. The Black Widows. These Chechen women who have lost their husbands in the what they may well view as the battle for, you know, independence from Russia. Strapping on explosives. And they've been killing people in Russia now for some time. And so so we're taking the position that if we go into the Middle East to an oil-rich nation like Saudi Arabia, and we put a base there, we put our soldiers there, that's an okay thing to do, and that if Osama and his friends don't like that and they decide that they're going to attack us as they did on 9/11 with this declaration of, you know, we're doing this because you are defiling Saudi soil, that's not a justification. We're never going to talk to these guys. We're never going to negotiate with them. And yet we've got now these groups, Thomas Keene, Elliot Abrams, Ken Edelman, Richard Pearl, William Crystal, Cap Weinberger, James Woolsey, telling the Russians that they need to be negotiating with the Chechens, with their terrorists, who happen to be occupying oil-rich territory south of Russia, while we're occupying oil-rich territory south and east of Chechnya. We won't talk to our terrorists. We're just going to kill them. They have to talk to their terrorists, we say. Putin is not buying it. And I'm telling you, this is something that could blow up in our faces so big it is unimaginable. And I'm just amazed that more people aren't talking about it. Hey, Victoria Jones in the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with our daily report of what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm pretty good.
Good.
So,
what do you have for us?
Well, first of all, quick comment. I do think what you said was fascinating, and the lack of reporting on the Russian planes and also on the school during the Republican convention, because apparently the media thinks we can't handle two stories at a time, has been really quite shocking.
Well, the thing
definitely will haunt us, I think.
Yeah, the story that it is not being reported that chills me is when Vladimir Putin turned to an American reporter two or three days ago and said, I'm paraphrasing now, I don't have the quote in front of me, but he said, we don't tell you to go to Osama bin Laden's cave and negotiate with him. Don't you tell us to go to Chechnya and negotiate with these people who are killing our people.
And actually, at one point he called them bastards.
Yeah, exactly. And
on the record too, so
yeah.
he's not mincing words.
No.
So it is fascinating. I think the whole preemption thing is, at some point this was going to happen, you know, with one country or another. So it is tricky. But you're right; it isn't being talked about here. Internationally, though, encouragingly, Secretary of State Colin Powell testifying today before one of the major Senate intelligence, I think it was Foreign Affairs, I'm not sure, about Sudan, said that in his opinion genocide has been committed.
In the Sudan?
In the Darfur region of the Sudan by the Janjaweed. So he has actually said that.
Hmm.
And previously that has not been said. It really is a very big deal.
Yeah.
And that he considers that it may well be time to bring in the United Nations on this.
Yeah.
Yes, Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So that changes the parameters a little bit. If Secretary of State says that from the U.S., that does change things. So that'll be very interesting.
Yeah.
Then I was at the Senate Armed Services Committee today, which is, as you and your listeners know, is a very powerful committee. Chairman Warner, then Levin, you've got Kennedy, you've got McCain, you've got Lindsey Graham. You've got Harry Reid from Nevada. You've got a lot of people on there who have very strong views on these issues, and it was more on the investigation into Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, and what came out of it?
Well, I make copious notes, and I was trying to figure out what was coming out of it, and some of it seemed to be a repeated question of, did General Sanchez ask for more military police? Did he ask for more troops? There is this report known as the Schlesinger Report, which seems to be the final report on this, which is 9,000 pages long. And one senator had his staffers bring in boxes of paper. and there were 16 of those boxes of paper like you buy at Staples that were 9,000 pages, and then he showed us what 176 pages is, and he says that's how many pages are declassified. So he attempted to make a big deal out of this.
You know, couldn't that much of that report though be boiled down to the simple reality that typically in field situations, military police, by and large, and in fact in domestic situations here in the United States in prisons, they try to have between a 1 in 3 and a 1 in 5 guard to prisoner ratio. And that at Abu Ghraib they had 1 to 70.
At its best it was about 1 to 8. At its worst it got to about 1 to 70. It varied. It seemed to vary really quite considerably, which was interesting. But they also wanted to talk about lessons learned. But Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham also wanted to talk about culpability. Lindsey Graham making the point, as he asked about more senior generals, who clearly had been that the word culpable or responsible was used frequently, said that he felt strongly that that it shouldn't just be enlisted people who are going to be court-martialed if anyone's going to be court-martialed.
So we now have senior senators talking about let's pin the tail on somebody.
Right, and Senator Lindsey Graham, who is not exactly a Democratic dove, a former JAG officer, Republican, and pretty tough on these issues. Senator McCain had a terrific exchange, which you'll probably see on the news, because of all the really ticked off senators, it was like who has the best exchange, and there were some good ones.
Yeah.
But McCain was very ticked off because there was material that needed to be gotten from the CIA, and. And this is really very important material, and he was asking the generals, well, did you get it? Well, no, we did, but, they said they needed to do, an investigation, or they needed to do this, that, and the other, and McCain just was furious. He said, well, why did you accept that? Why didn't you tell them we don't accept that? We want the documents.
Yeah.
We want the documents. These are documents the CIA had. They were obligated to turn over, and they didn't. And the general just said, I don't have a good answer for you.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
So it is fascinating.
The Republicans are starting to eat their young.
Well, yeah, I have to say I've attended a lot of these hearings during August, and McCain and Lindsey Graham have been all over this from the beginning. Lindsey Graham has been more ticked off than almost anybody else. You know, as a former JAG officer, he feels very, very strongly that doing the right thing and honor and obeying the law, being seen to obey the law, is very important. And I had a pretty low opinion of Senator Lindsey Graham before this.
He was one of the leaders of the impeach Clinton bunch.
He was,
And
it's always interesting to me when you and I say this to other people, and I've been shown up to myself for what I am. People are very complex.
Sure. Yeah, it's true. It really is true. It's the liberal thing. You must be a liberal, Victoria.
I know. I suppose I must be. I'm going to go and take a bath.
Yeah, there you go.
Wash it off quick before it sticks.
I think it's great. I think it's wonderful that we have reporters who actually understand that people are not, can't be boiled down to sound bites. This is the point I keep making to people who call in about George W. Bush. And they say, oh, he's just an idiot, And I say, no, he's not. And he's a very dangerous man, and he's a very complex man. And we need to understand those things. But anyhow, but we digress. So is that the news from Washington, basically?
That's pretty much the news from Washington today. Yeah, I would say so. Those are the big stories.
Okay. Did you know, by the way, that the foreign minister of the rebels, the Chechen rebels, the leader, their equivalent of Osama bin Laden is a guy named Aslan Mashtikov. And their foreign minister, who would be the equivalent of the guy that, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, is a guy by the name of Ilyas Akhmadov, that we have given Akhmadov refuge, asylum in the United States. Can you imagine?
I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me.
Can you imagine if Russia gave asylum to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or to Osama bin Laden, how we would respond? What would we do?
We would have gone ape leap.
Yeah. Yeah, there you
completely.
Go. Completely. Yeah.
But, you know, we seem to have a history of being very naive when it comes to, and separatist is a great word, and I there are faults on all sides, and that's no question. But America has been incredibly naive, for example, about the IRA, and so it supported, you know, this notion of freedom fighting, not realizing that the people like me who had been commuting in London for 20 years routinely had our trains canceled and didn't know whether we were going to be blown up by the people who Americans were in good faith giving money to NORAD, thinking that they were helping widows and children. And in fact, they were going to arm and train terrorists who were training with Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. We can't have it both ways. We can't have it both ways, and we're trying to. This administration is trying to, in my opinion, it's because we would like to have more of the Caucasus. We would like to have more of the Caspian region. That's where there's so much oil, and Chechnya is a major. At one point in time, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was the leading oil producer in the region. It's not now, but it's a major. I mean, you can't have an oil pipeline without Chechnya. And just like you can't without Afghanistan. I mean, if Hamid Karzai, when he was an oil consultant to Unocal and was negotiating the pipeline across Afghanistan, now he's miraculously the president of Afghanistan.
Isn't that amazing how that happened?
Yeah. So anyway, Victoria, thanks for the call. And thank you for letting me rant at you.
Oh, rant away.
Okay. It's great to hear from you. And,
Thanks very much.
Yeah, and give our best to Ellen, and we'll talk with one of you tomorrow. All right?
Indeed. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. It's 13 minutes before the hour. The leading Russian critics of Putin's handling, this story in The Guardian yesterday by John Laughlin called The Chechens' American Friends. Wake up, folks. The leading Russian critics of Putin's handling of the Beslan crisis are the pro-U.S. politicians Boris Nemtsov and Vladimir Ryzhkov, men associated with the extreme neoliberal market reforms. By neoliberal, they mean in favor of corporations completely controlling everything. Right, it's a word that has a reverse meaning in the rest of the world than it does here in the United States, which so devastated the Russian economy under the West's beloved Boris Yeltsin and the Carnegie Endowment's Moscow Center. This is a think tank that works with the RAND Corporation in Russia, and has been basically, well, here, quoting John Laughlin, he says, these people peddle essentially the same line as that expressed by Chechen leaders themselves, and that being that this is independence, freedom fighters, and all that sort of thing, which is the same position, or a very similar position, that many of the folks in Iraq right now are saying that this is why they are fighting us. I mean, there are these specific factions in Iraq. You've got the nationalists associated with Sadr, who are nationalists and religious, and because they're nationalists, they may be drawn into a political process. You've got the religious fundamentalists. You've got pure nationalists, secular nationalists, people who just want this is our nation. Sometimes we call them the leftover Baathists. You've got the foreigners who are in there now. Now that George Bush, has kicked open the doors, we said, hey, any country, anybody can come in here and trade now. No problem. We got rid of all the border guards, and suddenly there's thousands of foreigners in the country. And they've taken over Fallujah and five other cities. You've got the foreigners in there who are just, making trouble. And you've got perhaps the agents of Iran who simply want to destabilize the situation. But you've got, and in Chechnya, a very similar situation. A very similar mess that Russia has. And we're going in and we're trying to tell them how to do it. We're saying, well, you just have to negotiate with these people. And Putin is not buying it for a minute. Would we? I don't think so. 10 minutes before the hour.
Do you want to own a computer? Is your credit less than perfect? If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, then you are already approved for a brand new IBM, Dell, eMachine, or other name brand computer guaranteed. You heard right. Bad credit? No credit? No problem. There is no credit check, so you will not be turned down. If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, you are approved for your brand new name brand computer. Just call 800-588-0596. Freedom Frog Funding says you are approved. So give us a call today at 800-588-0596 to have your brand new computer shipped right to you. And if you act now, we'll add a $200 upgrade and a one-year warranty for free. You heard right. We will upgrade your computer and throw in a warranty absolutely free. So don't wait. Let Freedom Frog Funding send you the computer of your dreams today. Call 800-588-0596. That number is 800-588-0596.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies. On September 17th, I'll be broadcasting live on WTKG AM 1230 in Grand Rapids at the Celebration Cinema, noon to 3 p.m. at the corner of Knapp and East Beltline. Drop by early at 11 a.m. in the Wave Room for a get-together, then listen to the show. At 4 p.m. after the show, I'll be at Schuller Bookstore on 28th Street for a book signing. For more information, call 616-776-5541. That's 616-776-5541.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Econonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Econonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
The shipping industry takes a closer look at its own exhaust. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. A huge portion of international trade is carried across the oceans by more than 35,000 ships. These ships burn a lot of fuel and release a lot of exhaust. The International Maritime Organization is trying to cut down on that exhaust to lessen the impact of shipping on air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. Jim Corbett is a marine policy expert at the University of Delaware. He says exhaust from ships accounts for a small fraction of the world's greenhouse gas pollution, especially from carbon dioxide. But as global trade increases, so will the number of ships at sea. Corbett says the shipping industry is trying to cut emissions now instead of dealing with more serious pollution in the future. Corbett says the International Maritime Organization is looking for ways to cut exhaust by improving efficiency. For example, better designs for the propeller can maximize its efficiency at propulsion, and better designs for the hull can lower the friction of a moving ship against the water. Those kinds of changes can improve fuel efficiency, and that cuts down the amount of exhaust. Corbett says these changes take years to put into effect. He says they're most cost-effective when they're built into new ships rather than retrofitted into old ones.
These hull and propeller changes, making the vessels smoother and making the power transfer better, have been shown to have the most potential within a context of a fleet modernization, of implementing newer designs into the fleet. They're a little bit less effective for existing engines.
Corbett says the efforts to reduce carbon dioxide pollution are part of a much larger effort to reduce all kinds of air pollution from ocean-going vessels. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
but try to put a smile. Take a break for a while. Take a risk. Do your very best. Take 5 points.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is where it gets really, really messy. You start looking at the fact that it's the same people who put together the project for a new American century, the neocons who engineered, who came up with the idea, you've got to invade Iraq, we've got to secure the Middle East, we're not going to become oil independent, instead we're going to become empire. We're not going to do what Jimmy Carter, we're not going to go down that road he talked about. I mean, the guy was just a nuclear engineer on a submarine. He only knew all about how energy works, right? No, we're not going to go down that road. Yeah, he was. Jimmy Carter joined the U.S. Navy in 1942. He was in active duty until, what, 56, 58, something like that? Anyhow, we're not going to go down that road. No, instead, we're going to bully the world into giving us the oil we need. And wherever there's oil, we will show up. And these same guys, Richard Pearl, Ken Edelman, William Kristol, James Woolsey, Jeb Bush actually signed the Project for a New American Century 1998 letter encouraging Bill Clinton to invade Iraq. There's not complete overlap, but they've got another committee, the American Committee for Peace in Chechnya, that is, you know, trying to tell Vladimir Putin that he needs to negotiate with the Chechens. Why are we messing in these? Why are we messing in other countries' internal affairs or even their external affairs? This doesn't affect us. Sometimes it's really harsh to say that. I know. Let it be fought out in the United Nations. That's what it's there for. Not us. Why are we giving asylum to the number two guy in the Chechen separatist movement? What we call the separatist movement, what the Russians call the Chechen terrorist movement. Why? Could it have to do with that being one of the most oil-rich parts of the world? And if the guy that we gave refuge, sanctuary to here in the United States ends up in control, we'll have access to even more oil? Could it be? Given who these folks are who are promoting this? I mean, these guys, these neocons are really creating a mess for us. We need to go back to the Monroe Doctrine. He was the fifth president of the United States, I believe. If it doesn't directly affect us, we're not going to get involved. Except through the United Nations, you know, in a rational way. So speak up, but what? This is an absolute train wreck waiting to happen. And I encourage you to get in touch with your elected officials and ask them, why are the neocons pushing Russia on Chechnya with this whole thing? It's dangerous.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hart.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Women who were dismissed from employment in the 1950s and early 60s for being married or pregnant may be one step closer to receiving long-denied pensions. On Tuesday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a group of women who say that Minnesota Power in Duluth discriminated against them by placing penalties on their pensions based on outdated gender rules. In the 50s and 60s, Minnesota Power had a policy that women employed with them who became married or pregnant were to be laid off. Many of the women were able to get their jobs back in the late 70s or early 80s, but when they retired, the company refused to count their first years of employment toward their pension. The ruling allows the women to proceed with their lawsuit. If the suit is won, it could set a precedent for millions of other women who faced similar discrimination decades ago and are now reaching retirement age.
Delta Airlines announced a major restructuring plan yesterday in an effort it says will allow the company to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline is closing its Dallas-Fort Worth hub, eliminating 7,000 jobs and 10% of its workforce. Also in the mix is an across-the-board wage cut for all employees, which Delta says is necessary due to increased competition and fuel prices. Older members of the pilots union are threatening to retire early if Delta doesn't promise to protect their accrued benefits. Rick Aronson is a Boeing 757 pilot.
We're tired of jobs going overseas, and in the airline industry, we're afraid our pensions are going to be lost, and we're afraid that President Bush is going to allow foreign carriers to take our American airline jobs.
The airline industry overall is in crisis, with United Airlines having already filed for bankruptcy, and American and ATA have threatened bankruptcy.
When employees walked out of a Nestle USA plant in Freehold, New Jersey last month, attempting to get the company to sit down at the bargaining table, they were offered a Hobson's choice. Accept the new company-wide health care program or stay out on strike and lose their paychecks and benefits altogether. The workers said that it was the first time in that factory's history that the company has not allowed workers to negotiate where the cost of their benefits will go. In order to protect their jobs, the workers relented and returned to work. The strike was not necessarily about rising health care costs as much as it was about workers losing their voices in the company.
Here's today's Del Bob Report. Cash-strapped parents are feeling the pinch as schools across the country increase the price of lunch due to rising costs. The average high school lunch costs about $1.66 and $1.43 for elementary school lunches. According to a recent survey by Education Week, price increases ranged anywhere from 30 cents in Atlanta to $1 in California. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
After 9/11, there was a headline on a French paper, "Today We Are All Americans." We had the world on our side in a way that hasn't been seen since post-World War II. Within, you know, a few months after that, with the obsession with Iraq, it was washed away. I was a registered Republican, now I'm a Democrat, and I'm voting for John Kerry in November.
Move On PAC is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
It's always a hoot to hear corporate lobbyists wailing to the high heavens about the scourge of frivolous lawsuits, demanding that Congress bar people from suing them. But guess who files the biggest number of frivolous lawsuits in America? Corporations. They sue their competitors, consumers, shareholders, critics, the media, public interest groups. They'll sue their own mama just to squeeze out another dime. For an example of litigious corporate absurdity, come to Lavernia, Texas, and hoist a cool one with the good folks who are regulars at the True Blue Texas Roadhouse. Located 25 miles east of San Antonio, this rural bar serves up beer, chips, country music, and genuine Texas atmosphere. It's in a corrugated metal building that used to be a garage. It's the real deal. But the True Blue Texas Roadhouse has been sued by the corporate lawyers of a national restaurant chain calling itself Texas Roadhouse. This outfit, which operates 165 restaurants in 30 states, wrote to Doug Bodie in Lavernia, claiming that Bodie's Texas True Blue Texas Roadhouse was violating the chain's trademark name and, get this, deceiving the consuming public into thinking this little bar in Lavernia is part of the chain. Now, get this. The chain has no Texas roots whatsoever. It began in Indiana and is headquartered in Kentucky. It dresses up its bars with Texas memorabilia, but it's a fake, profiting on the good name and spirit of genuine Texas roadhouses. Texas is where we live, says one of Bodie's regulars, which is way more than the plastic chain can claim. Bodie himself says, I'm just trying to make a living. For God's sake, I'm a Texas bar. Why can't I use that name? This is Jim Hightower saying, well, why can't he? If you'd like to tell the national chain where to go and tell it to leave Lavernia's genuine roadhouse alone, call the CEO, 502-426-9984.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live. It's Thursday afternoon, the time in the week when we go beyond politics into things maybe you thought you knew, but you didn't know, or you didn't even know that you needed to know. You didn't know that you didn't know that you didn't know, and maybe everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, it could be. Juliet Shore has written an incredible book that challenges conventional wisdom in some regards. Born to Buy. Juliet, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
And our number 1-866-889-8894, by the way. And Juliet, you in your book, you talk about, you suggest that you have solved the chicken egg dilemma. I used to work in advertising years ago, and I knew people who actually did advertising for tobacco companies, which I could never handle. And their rationale was always, well, you know, people are already buying tobacco, and we're just trying to get brand loyalty, shift them from Camels to Pall Mall or whatever. The corollary to that was in marketing to children that, well, you know, children already want to buy things. We're just going to help them make decisions. And then the one level deeper from that where people were making the argument that, that advertising was getting toxic, that, that the psychological techniques of advertising were being used to try to manipulate children who were at risk, children who were disturbed or emotionally fragile. It's those kind of kids who are more vulnerable to advertising, or is it that advertising is creating that kind of a vulnerability? What you really found this whole issue of kids with problems attracted to consumer culture. Talk about that for a minute.
In my book, I tried to ask a question that's never really been researched before in this way, which is, now that kids are more immersed in consumer culture than ever before, with incredible exposure to advertising, and they're more psychically tuned into brands and stuff and buying and so forth, what impact, if any, is that having on kids? And, of course, I was bedeviled by this question you raise. In a lot of studies, like the studies of TV, for example, you'll find that kids who watch a lot of TV are also depressed, high rates of depression. But is it that depressed kids turn on the TV all the time, or is the TV making them depressed? So I was able to sort out that question with a sort of advanced statistical technique in which I measured kids' level of involvement in consumer culture, their media use, and so forth. And then I gave them standard tests for depression, anxiety, self-esteem, psychosomatic complaints like stomach aches, headaches, how often do they get those? And what I found was that the more involved a kid got into consumer culture, the more depressed it would make them, the more anxious, the lower their self-esteem, the more their stomach aches and headaches. It wasn't the reverse, which is what I had. I thought actually both would be true. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that the depressed kids were more likely to go to consumer culture. It was that that consumer involvement itself was causing their depression and anxiety. And it was interesting because I went into the project, especially with the, I did a lot of interviews with parents, and I was noticing in those interviews, many of the real problem kids, they were fighting all the time with their parents about different aspects of consumer culture, mm-hmm. how much TV mm-hmm. they watch, the Game Boy, the Nintendos, right. the fast food, etc.
Right.
And what the research showed was those influences were causing the problems.
Interesting. So, and you know, there are some, Marie Wynne, The Plug-In Drug, Joseph Chilton Pierce's book, Evolution's End, have posited this around TV itself, just as a medium. But here, you're taking it beyond television to the entire consumer culture. I mean, the subtitle, A Commercialized Child, the New Consumer Culture. Define culture for us in this context.
Well, I defined it more broadly than just media, because I actually did also measure their TV usage and other media usage. And then what I found was that those effects flowed through this more of a psychological structure in the kids' heads, where I asked about stuff like how often do you think of stuff you want to buy, or when you go somewhere, do you always need to buy something? How much do you like commercials? How much do you care about designer labels? Is being cool important to you? Do you care how much money your family have? Do you feel like other kids have more than you? Do you want to be rich? Does it matter to you what kind of car your family has? Do you choose your friends based on how much stuff they have? There were almost 20 of those different items in the survey. And then the kids, what I find is that the kids who watch a lot more TV score much more materialist or consumerist on all of those other
right.
items, which is kind of what you expect. And then that psychological involvement with consumer culture, that ever-present sense of desire and dissatisfaction and always wanting stuff and caring about being cool and always comparing yourself to what other kids have, those are the psychological mechanisms which then lead the kids to be more depressed and anxious feel worse about themselves.
Yeah, which then thus makes them even more vulnerable to the advertising, because then they need this, they think that they need this stuff to get out of the depression, and then it becomes this spiral.
Exactly.
I remember some a decade or two ago, Louise and I, my wife and I, were in the Middle East, and we were walking through a city that hadn't been inhabited in about 6,000 years. And in the ruins, there was actually some fairly intact ruins. And in the main room of the house, there was the corner of the room, there was etched into the walls, of course, very thick walls, stone houses or, you know, brick houses, etched into the walls was this opening about the size of a TV set. And the anthropologist, or archaeologist, rather, who was with us, said that's where the house gods would be placed. They would place figures there who would, you know, look over the house and who would, the local gods or goddesses or whatever, the figurines. And I just looking at that, you know, I thought, well, okay, you know, in a modern American house, that's where the TV would be. And then all of a sudden it hit me, TV is the voice of God in our culture, right? It's the voice of our, or at least the voice of our culture to us.
Yeah.
You know, traditionally, the gods were the voice of the culture. And TV is the voice of our culture. It sits in that sacred place in our living space, and informs us about what our culture is all about and who we are relative to it and how we should behave and how we should think. First of all, I'm assuming that you buy that as an argument.
I do. Okay. And then the problem with kids, I mean, I think it's a problem for everyone, but in the case of kids, the problem is that we've allowed MTV, you know, Viacom and Nickelodeon and Disney and Coca-Cola and McDonald's and so forth to be the word of God.
Right, to control the words.
It's some very pernicious gods inside that box.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So this raises then the question, if it is not just the media that is toxic, but an entire culture which has become toxic as a consequence of, you know, some would argue unrestrained, you know, laissez-faire capitalism or something, just, you know, a culture that worships greed rather than worshiping community, for example. How do we resolve this? How do we detoxify our culture? How do we take us, because presumably there have been times in the past when American culture was not as toxic.
Yeah. Well, you're in a period, you know, as you know, in which corporate influence and corporate political power is, you know, probably at an all-time high.
Well,
so
at least since 1880.
There are sort of two steps to it. One is inside the house. I mean, some obvious things like turning off that box. I've been raising my children TV-free. I think it's the best thing I, you know, ever decided to do as a parent. So you don't actually have to participate in that part of it, in that media part of it. You can, you know, there's independent media, and there's, you know, there's great alternative shows like the one we're on right now.
There you go.
But that's, I think that's step one, because so much of that commercial influence stems from electronic media to kids. Second thing is, it requires a political movement, a social movement, and it's starting. Parents are beginning to wise up to the ways in which their children are being exploited by corporations. And you can go to a couple of different places to join up with other people who are fighting this. There's commercialalert.org, which has developed the Parents' Bill of Rights. I also have it reproduced in my book.
Mm-hmm.
This is a series of 9 steps that we're trying to get introduced into Congress and also into some state legislatures to turn back that tsunami of advertising directed at kids. And, you know, some of these things are really basic, like the people who make an ad should be forced to put their name to it. So that they're going to have to take some responsibility.
You mean the agency itself? This ad brought to you by Ogilvy and Mather?
Well, actually, individuals.
Oh,
not only Ogilvy.
Ralph
and Mather,
at O&M made this ad?
Excuse me?
Ralph Johnson at O&M helped make this
ad? Exactly.
But
why
but,
not? And I think that once the people in the industry,
30 people might. Yeah, but 30 people might be involved in producing an ad, and by then you don't have any ad time left if you're just reading their names.
No, it's not on the actual, it's not what's shown. It's that they have to put it up on their company website.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's like a disclosure statement when
right.
an ad gets aired. These are the, and it would only be the principal people involved.
Mm-hmm.
These are the, you know, key people who are involved in the making of this ad. It's up there so that parents know who made that ad, who they could begin to hold responsible.
Try to bring some sense of accountability to the whole issue here.
Exactly. I mean, I did a lot of research inside advertising agencies. I had a lot of people confessing to me that they felt guilty about what they were doing.
Yep.
But the whole culture in the agency is to not take responsibility. It's an incredible fear of sort of saying, let's look at the ethics of what we're doing, or let's look at the ethics of manufacturing this, or of promoting this particular product. I mean, I have people who say to me, I would never let my children use the products that I'm advertising.
Yeah.
Well,
but they're paying, you know, a couple hundred grand a year to for these efforts, you know, so, I mean, people need to make a living, right?
Instrumental use of children that I don't think is ethical.
Yeah. And therefore, this is an appropriate point of intersection between government and the marketplace.
Yeah, here's another one.
We have about 30 seconds left.
Disclosure for product placement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a hot new area for marketing is product placement in television and movies.
Right.
Not only there, but those are two key places.
Yeah.
Those don't have to be disclosed. if you're advertising to our kids, you should have to disclose that you're doing that.
Yeah, in fact, this is one of the major tools of the tobacco industry and has been for the last decade to get kids into this. Juliet Shore, Juliet B. Shore, the book Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And I encourage you to check it out, Born to Buy by Juliet Shore. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Work Zone Safety Clearinghouse, work zone-related fatalities dropped substantially last year. In 2003, there were 1,028 work zone deaths nationwide as compared to 2002, when there was 1,186. Texas holds the record for most deaths over the last 2 years with a combined total of 358. Georgia is the most improved, going from 118 fatalities in 2002 and dropping to 24 in 2003.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Log Cabin Republicans have made a decision. The Gay Republicans group, the national board, has just voted 22 to 2. 24 folks, apparently, on the national board. 22 to 2, the Log Cabin Republicans have voted not to endorse George W. Bush as president of the United States. Now, I realize there are some folks out there who would say, well, you know, this is a relatively small group of people and, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Nonsense. Nonsense. An estimated, here, this from an article in the Los Angeles Times by Johanna Newman, an estimated 1 million gay Americans voted for George Bush in 2000. 1 million, according to exit polling of voters on Election Day. Some demographers believe that if Bush loses any of this support because of his backing of a constitutional amendment that would prohibit same-sex marriage, it could hurt the president's chances in November of winning several battleground states, Florida, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, and Washington. For example, in Florida, where had the entire state been recounted, the New York Times, the Washington Post, this consortium of news agencies found Al Gore would have won by any way that you calculated it, had the entire state been recounted. Had only a few of the counties been recounted, which, like an idiot, was the way that Al Gore was asking for it initially, then George Bush would have won by 537 votes, more or less. That was the ultimate certification by Catherine Harris. Was then rewarded with a House and a seat in the House of Representatives. Anyhow, the exit polling in the 2000 election showed that in that election in Florida, that Bush so-called won by 537 votes, 45,000 gays voted for Bush. Now, if that election is that tight this year, I mean, you know, they've still got, what, 30, 40,000 black folks that they've knocked off the rolls. They just tried to add more to it with this, you know, phony scam of, oh, they were felons. Well, somebody by their name in Texas was a felon. Well, it's somebody with a similar name in Texas was a felon. That's still out there. They had to keep that in place so Jeb could get reelected in 2002. But I don't think even that may be enough. If all the gay voters in Florida just say, nope, sorry, we're going elsewhere. Patrick Guerrero, the group's executive director, this is the Log Cabin Republican, says, this is a battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. That fight is bigger than one platform, one convention, or even one president. And, you know, I would agree. I don't think just the issue of gay marriage, it's also going to be a battle in the Democratic Party, by the way, coming down the road. But the Republican Party wanting to amend the Constitution of the United States for only the second time in history to reduce the rights of we the people. The first time, of course, being prohibition, when they amended the Constitution to say we the people do not have the right to drink alcohol. I mean, you could. There are laws, of course, that restrict our behaviors, our rights, whatever you want to call it. But amending the Constitution is not there to grant us rights or to restrict our rights. The Constitution is there to limit the privileges and powers of government. And the Republican Party is now on record as saying that they want to misuse the Constitution to write into the Constitution a reduction of the rights of individual citizens. In my opinion, an absolute violation of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, and certainly the spirit of the Constitution itself, which is that these should be issues that are decided by the states or by we the people through the ballot process. I mean, very straightforward stuff here. And the Republicans are on record in favor of discrimination against what may be as much as a tenth of the United States, depending on whose studies you're looking at. Certainly, you know, somewhere between 3 and 5%, maybe even more. And these are people who vote. God bless them. And be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how this stuff all shakes out, too. 29 minutes past the hour.
To tonight on NBC, the premiere of Must See TV Thursday with the most anticipated comedy of the year, Joey.
I thought you and Chandler should have moved out a long time ago. It's a very vibrant gay scene.
Chandler and I are not a gay couple.
You know you're going to check it out. Then, The Apprentice is back. New tasks, new competition. Same Donald.
You're fired.
Joey and The Apprentice, plus a sneak preview of Medical Investigation. NBC tonight.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Women who were dismissed from employment in the 1950s and early 60s for being married or pregnant may be one step closer to receiving long-denied pensions. On Tuesday, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a group of women who say that Minnesota Power in Duluth discriminated against them by placing penalties on their pensions based on outdated gender rules. In the 50s and 60s, Minnesota Power had a policy that women employed with them who became married or pregnant were to be laid off. Many of the women were able to get their jobs back in the late 70s or early 80s, but when they retired, the company refused to count their first years of employment toward their pension. The ruling allows the women to proceed with their lawsuit. If the suit is won, it could set a precedent for millions of other women who faced similar discrimination decades ago and are now reaching retirement age.
Delta Airlines announced a major restructuring plan yesterday in an effort it says will allow the company to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline is closing its Dallas-Fort Worth hub, eliminating 7,000 jobs and 10% of its workforce. Also in the mix is an across-the-board wage cut for all employees, which Delta says is necessary due to increased competition and fuel prices. Older members of the pilots union are threatening to retire early if Delta doesn't promise to protect their accrued benefits. Rick Aronson is a Boeing 757 pilot.
We're tired of jobs going overseas, and in the airline industry, we're afraid our pensions are going to be lost, and we're afraid that President Bush is going to allow foreign carriers to take our American airline jobs.
The airline industry overall is in crisis, with United Airlines having already filed for bankruptcy, and American and ATA have threatened bankruptcy.
When employees walked out of a Nestle USA plant in Freehold, New Jersey last month, attempting to get the company to sit down at the bargaining table, they were offered a Hobson's Choice. Accept the new company-wide health care program or stay out on strike and lose their paychecks and benefits altogether. The workers said that it was the first time in that factory's history that the company has not allowed workers to negotiate where the cost of their benefits will go. In order to protect their jobs, the workers relented and returned to work. The strike was not necessarily about rising health care costs as much as it was about workers losing their voices in the company.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Cash-strapped parents are feeling the pinch as schools across the country increase the price of lunch due to rising costs. The average high school lunch costs about $1.66 and $1.43 for elementary school lunches. According to a recent survey by Education Week, price increases ranged anywhere from 30 cents in Atlanta to $1 in California. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, and what's good for the goose is good for the gander department. Yeah, it's making me dizzy, I'll tell you. Our daily mislead. George Bush attacked the National Guard service of others. The White House is currently attacking those who raise questions about George W. Bush's National Guard record. They say the questions about Bush's failure to fulfill his commitment are dirty politics. Notes the Daily Mislead at mislead.org, yet a look at the record shows that it was President George Herbert Walker Bush and his top campaign strategist George W. Bush who tried to smear the National Guard and military record of their opponents. As reported in the August 23, 1988 Los Angeles Times, then Vice President George H.W. Bush's campaign co-chairman John Sununu went on national television to impugn Lloyd Benson dealing with the National Guard during Vietnam. Benson, of course, was running for vice president. Sununu specifically claimed Senator Lloyd Benson, Democrat of Texas, had improperly helped his son get into the Texas National Guard during Vietnam. Benson's son served in the very same National Guard unit at the very same time as George W. Bush. The Bush campaign's attacks came just days after Bush's allies in Capitol Hill launched a vicious attack on Governor Michael Dukakis, the presidential candidate, for receiving a draft deferment during the Korean War. At the time of this coordinated attack, the senior advisor to the George H.W. Bush campaign was a fellow by the name of George W. Bush. Can you believe it? I mean, it's make you crazy. Yeah. So some of the questions. Oh, let me actually, before I get to that, get to this here first. I think this is really something cool. South Charleston, West Virginia, Mayor Richie Robb said today he may vote against George W. Bush in the Electoral College, even if George W. carries the electoral vote of West Virginia. You get this? This is fascinating stuff. This is how the Electoral College was originally organized, why it was put into place, was that the founders thought that it, because of the distances involved, I mean, back in 1787, the distance, or 1787 when the Constitution was first put together and the Electoral College was worked out, the distance between Georgia, one of the states, and Washington, D.C., or New York, which was then the seat of government, the head of where government was based, was substantial. And the average citizen of Georgia couldn't hear the debates going on in New York between the presidential candidates, or among the various people who might run for president. They could read the newspapers, but I mean, it was too far away. And so the idea was that the people of Georgia would get together, or of any state, but I'm just using a Georgia as for example, would get together and they would elect a council of wise elders. The founders actually based this on a concept that came from the pre-Norman invasion, the pre-1066 invasion of England, when England was largely tribal. From the time that the Romans left around 400 AD until 1066, and prior to the Roman invasion in, what was it, 52 BC, I think it was, that when the English Isles were tribal and run as small democracies, and these various tribal groups would get together and they would elect councils of wise elders who would then go make the long trip to the national center, and they would then decide who would become the leader of the nation. And so the whole idea was the citizens of Georgia would elect electors. Not that they would elect a presidential candidate, that they would vote for people in their community who they considered wise. And those wise elders would then go to New York or Washington, D.C. later on, and they would evaluate the candidates, and the people back home in Georgia would trust them because they were local people that they knew. They would evaluate the candidates, and they would make the wise decision. This was the whole idea behind the Electoral College, and it's been changed over the years because of party politics by and large, to the point now where electors, you know, you're voting for the electors, but the electors just basically are doing what the party says, and the electors go as the state goes, and all this kind of stuff, and it's just been very much changed from the original idea. And, of course, many people say we should get rid of the Electoral College. Well, to do that, you're going to have to amend the Constitution. It's going to be very difficult. Over 19,000 amendments to the Constitution have been proposed since it was first passed. And, what, fewer than 30 have been successfully passed? I don't. What are we up to, 29? I'd have to go look. In any case, very few have made it, let's say. So why not make use of the Electoral College in the way it was intended? Let's actually elect electors, the wise people from our local communities, and then let them figure out who's going to be president. That's one way to go. It's frankly, I don't think we need to in this day and age, because we don't have to hop on the back of a horse and travel for 3 days in order to hear a presidential speech anymore. But South Charleston, West Virginia Mayor Richie Robb says that he's going to do what the Electoral College was actually, I mean, these are not his words, they're mine, what the Electoral College was actually intended for, and that is to vote the way that they think that the people in their community would want voted, or that is in the best interest of the people in their community, to use their wisdom. He's one of the five Republican electors that the Republican Party selected back in June. And the fact of the matter is, oddly, West Virginia is the state where the last time an elector changed their mind, that was Margaret Leach of Huntington, West Virginia, who, even though Michael Dukakis carried West Virginia in 1988, she refused to vote for him. So, you know, West Virginia has, it's interesting. There's only been 8 times in American history this has happened. And I say to South Charleston Mayor Richie Robb, good on you. Congratulations. Well done. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to call in. Rob in Newtown, Pennsylvania. This is Rob of opednews.com, I assume.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I got 3 things I want to talk to you about.
Try
to keep it quick.
All right.
One, I went down. Bush was in Pennsylvania today, and I was down in one of those, quote, free speech zones, half a mile from as close as they let us get to Bush.
They put you in a cage, huh?
Well, no, but they had about 40 cops wearing Kevlar and black units and lots of handcuffs, like they're drooling ready to handcuff people. And there were about 200 of us there wearing anti-Bush shirts and pro-Kerry shirts and carrying signs. Mine said, George Hitler Bush, spineless coward and liar.
That's a little tough.
Well, hey, you wrote that wonderful article originally giving it the Rusticus name.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many ways.
Number one, I got a couple of the callers here. Number one, you.
All right, that was one. So it was very interesting. It was very surrealistic to see this huge group of cars, police cars and black SUVs, all with the lights shining, driving by at 40 miles an hour past all the people he wants to ignore so he could go and give a talk for 20 minutes to his hand-picked sycophants.
Right, for his photo op.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is, I've been tracking Bush's and Kerry's website activity. You know, that's been pretty predictive in the past of some elections, and it was neck and neck, right even, up until a couple until yesterday.
By website activity, you mean the number of people who are visiting their websites?
The amount of, right, exactly.
Right.
This is tracked by one of Amazon's subsidiaries, Alexa.
Right.
And on my website, I have a graph of the last 3 months of website activity for the Kerry campaign and for the Bush campaign, and but something beautiful happened today. It bounced back to where it was. Kerry's is way ahead of Bush's now.
Yeah. Now, do you think that might be because Bush's positions on the issues are fairly well known by everybody, pro, con, or in the middle, whereas Kerry's positions having some shades of nuance and having evolved?
No, I think that most of these websites, how's Howard Dean's guy's name again who did the website?
Joe Trippi. Joe Trippi, yeah.
Anyway, no, I think that the websites reflect campaign activity. People go there to find out about meetups, to give money, to things like that.
Huh.
They're working tools right now, and Kerry's is working more than Bush's.
Okay.
And the last thing I want to say is, in terms of, here's the spin that we need to put on the National Guard issue. Bush signed up for the National Guard, but he didn't fulfill his commitment. He wasted a fortune in government funds and then dropped the ball, or worse, deserted. There's a pattern here that attests to his character. In business, Bush was a serial failure, running business after business into the ground. Bush doesn't finish what he starts, and he doesn't keep his commitments. In other words, when it comes down to it, he's unreliable and can't be trusted. That's his life story.
Yeah.
Failure, unfinished work, and broken promises.
So this needs to be the mantra of the anti-Bush crowd.
Well, I think that it goes directly to the Rove model of attacking strengths.
Yeah, yeah. Well, well said. Okay.
And one last thing.
Sure.
Your book, I finished it. It's brilliant.
What would Jefferson do?
Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know how to butter me up. I appreciate it, Rob.
It's inspiring.
Great.
And I'll tell you, you know, it's not many history books that bring tears to your eyes occasionally.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Great job, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob. I appreciate
it. Take it easy.
Yep. 16 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Alan in Saluda, North Carolina. Is that Alan?
Yes, that's correct.
Hey, Alan, what's up?
Every once in a while I get in a debate about somebody about politics, and I'm just amazed
too, huh?
That people actually think it's okay to borrow money and give the majority of it to the wealthiest people in this country, and they think that they're going to give us jobs because of it.
Yeah, it hasn't quite worked out that way. We did get a slight economic bounce from Bush's tax cuts, about a 1% of GDP, but we've incurred about 3% of GDP as debt. So basically for every dollar of bounce that we got in terms of the economy picking up, we went $3 in debt, and we're going to have to pay that back ultimately as $4, $5, or $6 anywhere from now to 20 years from now.
Yeah, I actually tell these people that the middle class is the one that's going to have to pay the debt.
Good, and you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And we are right now. This year, we're paying $360 billion on debt that Ronald Reagan ran up so that he could make it look like he was had an economic recovery going. Ronald Reagan was the first guy to take us over $1 trillion in debt and did it, in a grand style. And as some of the cons say, well, it was Reagan who taught us the deficits don't matter. Yeah, right. I mean, it's... And tell that to George Herbert Walker Bush, who inherited the recession from, when the bill first started coming due. It doesn't work. The economic policies of this administration are fiscal suicide. They are absolute insanity. And they are hell-bent on destroying this country, in my opinion, and destroying the democratic institutions of this country and turning it all over to their corporate cronies and buddies. And it's wrong. Alan, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, Tom, earlier you had phrased something in a way that I was wondering if you intended to, that you felt that our needs, the country's needs for oil, was a driving factor in Bush invading Iraq, however ill done it was.
But yes, I do.
I see it as a much less noble thing than that. I don't think it's any effort to meet the country's needs. It had everything to do with meeting the needs of Enron, Bechtel, Halliburton.
See, it's increasingly, though, Dave, I think that, they're falling back on this, I forget what the guy's name who was the Secretary of the Treasury is, I recall, who said in the 1950s, what's good for General Motors is good for America. It's what's good for Enron is what's good for America, or what's good for, Halliburton is good. That's their song and dance. And
good for General Bullmoose, I think. But also, there's a point of logic in this to me that is pretty convincing. Saddam undoubtedly was a bad fellow and greedy in his own right and putting a lot of the oil profits into his Swiss bank accounts.
Sure.
Remove Saddam from the oil factor, and we did that. That his profits should be then out of the picture and the price of oil should drop off considerably. It hasn't. It's tripled. So that tells me that I'm inclined to suspect that some of our cooperatives have their hands in that.
Well, the price of oil is going up for several reasons. One, the availability of Iraqi oil has never really fully bounced back because of all the sabotage of the pipelines and because of the unrest in Iraq. They were expecting not only that they could have all the oil being pumped that Iraq had historically been able to pump, but that they would, by now, a year down the road, they would actually have new wells drilled and new pipelines in. And I mean, that was what Halliburton was given billions of dollars to do. Number two, you've got oil being a commodity that is speculated on, as most commodities are, but it's an essential commodity, and it's a commodity that is in large supply in areas of the world like Chechnya and Iraq, the Middle East, and the around the Caspian Sea and whatnot
that are
politically vulnerable.
You don't suspect that Halliburton and Enron and Exxon have their hands in that profit?
I don't think that they are big enough to control the world oil price. I think the world oil price is going up. Number one, the main reason, because world oil consumption is going up. India and China in particular exploding. Number one, consumption. Number two, because there is uncertainty, and so you've got speculators bidding up the price, and that's why it bounces in a $10 range. And number three, because there hasn't been a significant increase in the amount of oil in the market. Certainly not as much as the consumption has gone up, meaning that Iraq hasn't really come online. And that, I think that that's what's all about. Enron and these guys, they don't have to raise the price of oil to increase their profits. They raise the price of gasoline. And that's what's going on. The oil companies are making record profits right now. And it has nothing to do with the price of oil. It has to do with the price of gasoline. Dave, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Some are charging that there's a connection between Halliburton being awarded no-bid contracts in Iraq and the fact that Vice President Dick Cheney used to run the company. Of course there's a connection. Would you rather do business with a bunch of strangers who may charge less or with a dear, dear friend who knows what's in your heart? That's why Dick gets $1 million severance check from us at Halliburton every year. It reminds him who his friends are. Friends shouldn't have to compete for contracts. Friends don't need government oversight, and friends know who their friends are. Cronyism sounds like such a bad word. Try friendship instead. A really lucrative friendship. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Pick up the billionaires!
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy. Again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
Warming in the Arctic is having a dangerous impact on a native tradition. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Subsistence hunting remains a way of life in the far north. Author Charles Wolforth spent weeks on the Arctic ice with Eskimos during their annual hunt for bowhead whales.
The Inupiaq people on the North Slope have survived from time immemorial from the land. And even though they have a cash economy now, their whole culture and their real reason for being still rests on hunting the bowhead whale. And that's the center of their culture, and that's really the most important thing they care about spiritually and materially and socially.
Wolforth writes about his experience in his new book, The Whale and the Supercomputer. He says bowhead whales are plentiful. Ironically, it's the hunt that's in trouble.
The bowhead whale hunt has become very dangerous because it's done on sea ice in the springtime, and the sea ice has become unpredictable. It's thinned by 40% in the last few decades, and it's become less anchored to the bottom.
Wolforth says the changing conditions affect the Inupiaq whale hunters every moment they're on the ice.
I spent, you know, weeks with the hunters out on the ice in a constant state of anxiety as we were expecting disaster, you know, fear of being crushed by moving icebergs or in fear of breaking off and floating out into the ocean. And then the day that I left, the ice did break off and 100 whalers floated out into the ocean and had to be rescued by helicopter, which was a very dangerous process that lasted all through the night.
Woolforth says no lives were lost, only some equipment went into the sea, but he says it illustrates how changing conditions are making it difficult for Native Alaskans to continue their traditional way of life. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square.
It's coming. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just received a 9/11 truth.org has a what do you call it? A petition? A letter that they had asked if I wanted to sign, which I am seriously considering. It's addressed to basically, let's see, is there a specific, respected, no. It's an open letter, as it were. We want real answers about 9/11. We want truthful answers such as, number one, why were standard operating procedures for dealing with hijacked airlines not followed that day? Number two, why were the extensive missile batteries and air defenses around the Pentagon not activated during the attack? Number three, why did the Secret Service allow George W. Bush to complete his elementary school visit, apparently unconcerned about his safety or that of the school children? Number four, why hasn't a single person been fired, penalized, or reprimanded for the gross incompetence we witnessed that day? Number five, why was the investigation suspended into apparent insider trading of American and United Airlines stocks, which resulted in millions of dollars of traceable gains? Number six, why has Sybil Edmonds, a former FBI translator who claims to have knowledge of advance warnings, been publicly silenced with a gag order requested by Attorney General Ashcroft and granted by a Bush-appointed judge? Number seven, how could Flight 77, which reportedly hit the Pentagon, have flown back towards Washington, D.C. for 40 minutes without being detected by the FAA's radar or the even superior radar possessed by the U.S. military? Number eight, how were the FBI and CIA able to release the names and photos of the alleged hijackers within hours, as well as to visit houses, restaurants, and flight schools they were known to frequent? Number nine, what happened to the over 20 documented warnings given our government by 14 intelligence agencies or heads of state? Number 10, why did the Bush administration cover up the fact that the head of the Pakistani intelligence agency was in Washington, D.C. the week of 9/11 and had $100,000 wired to Mohammed Atta, considered the ringleader of the hijackers? Number 11, why did the 9/11 Commission fail to address most of the 23 questions posed by the families of the victims, in addition to almost all of the questions posed here? And number 12, why was Philip Zelikow chosen to be the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, even though he co-authored a book with Condi Rice? Good questions. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Louise for producing our show and Ira for engineering it, to Brad for our music, to Jay for writing and composing our theme music, to Mike and Ben for our archives, for the folks in our chat room. Thanks to you for showing up and listening, too. Do appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Be right back here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, the fate of the world and what we